The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
First, let me welcome you all to Washington College of Law. And in particular, there's some people who I need to thank for helping to make this day possible. First, obviously, the Washington College of Law at our dean, Claudio Grossman, Stacey Jackson Roberts, who's working on our technology right now, Brent Hessel, who helped to do some of the publicity and arrangements for the event, and of course, the person to my right, your left, Michael Gollin, who is the instrumental founder and guts of PIPA. So I'm going to turn it over to Michael in a second to talk a little bit about the history of PIPA and the origins of PIPA in the need for various forms of intellectual property pro bono legal services. There are, of course, other kinds of needs in regard to intellectual property that are not legal services, but we're a law school and PIPA was founded principally in regard to the legal needs. And we're also going to talk a little bit about the kinds of work that PIPA has done in the past, which I'm happy to say that the Washington College of Law...
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Which is to say that the...
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
The Washington College of Law has been, through our intellectual property clinic, has been happy to help with various projects for PIPA. I also teach in that IP clinic, and after Michael is done talking both about the work that PIPA has done and some of the current international needs, so the after it is what it is.
We have to get at least one person dialed in so that...
Yeah.
Right. So the bottom line is that after Michael talks about the work that PIPA has done and what he sees as some of the current needs for intellectual pro bono legal services based on a survey that PIPA conducted and based on practical experience running the pro bono referral network, I will chime in from the perspective of IP clinics and also from add a few words based on a conference that was held yesterday at George Washington University with our IP program here on the issues relating to transactional clinics and IP clinics and how both have similar needs in regard to client service and how that might shape some of the additional needs in this area, particularly domestically, but not exclusively domestically, because the kind of clients who we have domestically for those clinics are found also in other countries, and they have similar needs. So, without further ado, let me introduce Michael Gollin, who is a partner at Venable LLP, and let me reiterate, it is lovely to see you all, and for any of you who are watching the webcast, it is lovely to have you with us today. Mike.
Thank you. Thank you, Josh, and thanks for hosting, and I'm glad we're up and running here, and for those of us here on this beautiful Saturday in Washington, I think we all deserve commendations for being here instead of running around and playing outside, but it's an important topic.
You made a really nice day to be inside.
And for anybody who might be on the webinar, I don't know what the weather's like wherever you may be, but you can participate by dialing into the phone number and I think by emailing or by dialing in.
If you go to a particular web address, you can go to www.pidgip.org and in the right column you'll see events. Click on the Pidgip PIPA conference. That will lead you to another web page, and in the middle of that web page it'll say real-time webcast. Click on that link. You'll enter your information, but if you are already watching elsewhere, you must be in there.
Okay. So this is a great occasion. We've had just a couple of conferences that PIPA has coordinated over the years. and lately in the last couple of years, fewer than in a period where we had more funding to do that. And I want to say that this has really been done purely, this is as with most of what PIP has done, and especially in the last couple of years, purely volunteer activity through Josh's efforts, his idea of having this to pair with the IP clinical program, and the very nice reception we had last night. I want to thank the Venable Foundation, which is the charitable giving arm of my law firm, which supported this conference and the reception last night, and to AU for hosting the podcast and the follow-on information. So the and of course to everyone who's here, who obviously share a commitment to the public interest and a sense of what intellectual property can do to help promote the public interest. I think to me, it's a very complicated field, and it's important to simplify things. The simplest agenda for today, I think, is two words, needs and resources. What are the actual needs that people, particularly in developing countries, have for intellectual property services? And how do those needs tie into the broader public interest? And what are the resources that are required to meet those needs? And the resources come both in terms of the human resources, the people here and the many volunteers, and the financial resources which are used to leverage the human resources. So I'll just speak briefly about the history of PIPA, I guess going all the way back in my own experience to why I went to law school in the first place, which is with a certain public interest dedication to look as a scientist, as many people in IP are, looking at the interplay of science and society, how technology is best adapted into society. And like many law students, I had a strong public interest drive, and that was met in clinical education and various other activities. And we started if you will, a matchmaking service during law school so that second-year law students could go work in a nonprofit organization instead of working for a second-year summer at a law firm. And so that, I think, puts me in a grand category of a lot of young lawyers. And over the time, as I was an IP attorney, environmental attorney, I handled pro bono cases as they came up. But it became quite clear in the 90s that there was a larger and more complex and pressing need for intellectual property professionals to be helping people who couldn't afford their regular rates. And there was no organization to do that. And for years and years, people were saying they were clamoring for more help. And eventually, in 2002, we launched PIPA with a lot of people in this room and others who have joined over the years. And it was July 3rd, 2002, was our initial meeting, and it was talking with Fred Pavorny about the national security implications of what we do here, that it was in direct reaction, in some respects, to the 9/11 attacks and the America's sort of withdrawal from the world at the time that led to an equal and opposite, or not equal, but an opposite reaction to try to reach out and bring the positive aspects of creative engagement and intellectual property out into the world. So, and I won't belabor the history because there's a sort of an early biography of PIPA here called Answering the Call, Public Interest IP Advisors, that actually was presented at a conference that Chuck McManus organized back in 2003. And there's copies here for anyone who wants to take it, and it's available for download at pipa.org. But long and short of it is that we decided to organize an independent group rather than host it in a law school or in an existing organization. At the time, the intellectual property world in the international arena was divided really into two camps, sort of strongly pro-IP, more IP, stronger IP, and an anti-IP, IP is bad, and block IP. And PIPA sort of went right in the middle of that, saying, whatever it is, whatever you think it is, it's here, and the most important thing is how do people interact with the system to accomplish their needs or improve the system. And so it's simpler to have it as an independent organization to explain. And actually, PIPA was initially able to obtain funding from first from the Fogarty Center at NIH through Consulpate, through their International Cooperative Biodiversity Group program to help counsel the members of organization of consortia that were obtaining biological materials from developing countries and trying to develop first drugs and then agricultural products from them. And over the subsequent few years, PIPA was able to get grants from the Rockefeller Foundation to promote the matchmaking, the core matchmaking activities, and from the UK Department for International Development, and I'll talk in a moment about the survey that we did with that funding. And the Ford Foundation, which is actually still ongoing, and we still have a little bit of Rockefeller support that we're living off of at the moment. But the Ford Foundation was to do a report on, and this will trend towards the future of needs of intellectual property, but on future scenarios of where intellectual property will go and what the implications are for human development. So that's sort of a snapshot history of PIPA from pre-PIPA 2002 to the to 06, and really we haven't we've been, as we say, between grants since 07. So let me see. So can I launch a few thoughts? PIPA is a 501c3 organization with 500 registered volunteers, some of whom reflect much larger law firms, and so I think that there's, and the clinics who deploy, you know, many law students. I think it's safe to say we have on the order of 1,000 or more volunteer IP professionals who have expressed a willingness and desire to, to help. And over the years, we've had over 100 requests for assistance of various sorts, and we'll talk more about some of those specifics. And Josh is, I think, right in saying that that's the most clear way, those examples are the most clear way to illustrate what PIPA does. But as I've seen this organization go from an idea to a legal entity with staff and then to its current state, which is essentially a volunteer network, with a history and a knowledge base, really, I think it's safe to say, to look at it in terms of a commitment. So when things aren't quite going as smoothly as you like, you need to sort of dig down. And Josh referred to me as the guts of the organization, which I'll take as a compliment, because that means the hearts and mind have to be somewhere out here among you and the broader network. So we're looking at you for the brains and the heart of the organization. But so as I think it really is a good place to start with what's the commitment, what is PIPA about, what are we trying to accomplish. It's a good way to look at it. So this is just sort of a number of factors, I think, which drive people to come want to help through PIPA. Justice, fair access, the notion that I spent 25 years billing clients for my services and learned early on that to do that in a sustainable fashion, you have to provide more value than the cost. And that's true even if you're giving away your time. But that there are people who just can't afford to hire lawyers in the US or elsewhere, but they do need services, and that's one of the principal points of pro bono. Crucial, I think, to the formation of PIPA is this practical case-by-case approach rather than large-scale international policy, that solutions are found in the specific examples. A quiet settlement of a dispute that serves both parties' interests is just as important as some public announcement of a new language in an international treaty, and may never be seen, but it needs to follow. We've always focused on being lean and highly leveraged. Unfortunately, PIPA has never had the funding to send people on trips to pay for a lot of expenses, and very, very lean and focused on delivering services. the focus is grassroots up, not top down, find out what people need and try and meet those needs. Let people define what they need and help them meet that. Self-determination, again, that people, you shouldn't tell people what they need, although they may need some, they can, oftentimes organizations can use some guidance on what their options are, but to listen more than to dictate. Clearly, there's an uneven playing field between the rich countries and the poor countries, and between the richer people and the poorer people in any given country, and that affects the flow of innovation and creativity, access to drugs and agriculture, and so on. I think everybody involved in intellectual property somehow in their heart believes that innovation is a key to happiness and success for individuals and for communities. And I think that's what draws a lot of us to the field. And that, and if you want it, and then what follows from that is a desire to share that power and make it more universal. At the same time, technology can bring damaging effects, and so there's a desire to mitigate that. And generally, this final notion that all society benefits when poor people have access to competent advice, and fairness requires that that all people have, dealing with the complex issues of intellectual property, have access to professional help for them to deal with it. So that's basically, I think, really what PIPA is, aside from all the legal and structural and historical purposes. The plan that PIPA started with was essentially to be a referral service to match volunteers to people who need help. And what's proven true over the 7 years is that there is a huge supply and a growing supply of willing volunteers. And what we found, and in also in growing clarity, is that the ability to find people who can benefit from these services is difficult. It's harder to find those people. The people who are willing to volunteer, they show up. They've heard about PIPA. They find through the various. We've done a good job of reaching out through the law clinics, through the professional associations. People come, and there are plenty of volunteers. So. Our plan for reaching out to people in need has not gone as far as it should. We talked about this a bit last night, that the process of matching those people with needs to those who can provide it is not a trivial or simple task. It can take a lot of work, hand-holding, listening, interviewing, and understanding both the skills and interests of the people who are volunteering and the needs of the people who are coming for help. So there's... But we have, through an e-commerce model and through staffing, whether paid staff and volunteers, we've been able to meet those needs. Eventually, the long-term picture for PIPA, when we look back at the 10th and 25th anniversary of the founding of PIPA, we'll hopefully have a global network with regional bases in different countries. With their own flavor and under their own jurisdictions working to do this. And we'll be able to look back and say that we were a good example for volunteerism and pro bono IP services throughout the world. That will be, that's part of the big plan and will be part of PIPA's legacy, I hope. Focus on a practical rather than the theoretical. Theory is fine, but it means nothing until it's put into practice. PIPA's network includes these groups, the people who need help, the assistance seekers. We don't call them clients because PIPA doesn't represent clients per se as a general rule. Rather, it makes matches between people who represent clients. The volunteers, we talked about them. The collaborators, PIPA has a special niche. We'll talk about that a little more. It's developing countries, it's intellectual property. We've focused from the beginning not on domestic U.S. and not on associated needs like with transactional work and so forth. There are many other organizations involved with these types of things, and the policy groups and so forth. who interact very, I think, synergistically with PIPA's mission. And then the donors, of course, who provide the financial wherewithal to make this happen. Now, we were hoping to have donors in attendance today, and we invited a lot, but the sad fact is that most of the philanthropies and foreign aid organizations have bowed out, for whatever reason, from the public interest intellectual property world. And it beats the heck out of me why, because I can't think of a more leveraged, more important sector to invest in to build that. But for whatever reason, it may be 2002 mentality, or the notion that the theory and the policy level is a place to invest, or that this will just take care of itself without the need for assistance. But this predates the financial crisis, when there was still more money available. These organizations bowed out of funding in this area. So I think one takeaway for everybody here is to ask why and to lobby for the importance of supporting this sector with funding.
Let me just break in on that, which is to say that at least at a certain basic level, most of what we're talking about should not be seen as a political issue in the sense of, you know, strong rights, weak rights, or whatever. There's needs of people who don't have access to the justice system in a meaningful way and can't afford to do it. And I think that everyone recognizes that that is in, to the benefit of all parties, that they get the wherewithal to play in the system better. And to do so, again, requires the resources to do a lot more of the kinds of matchmaking that Michael is talking about, which require a real effort. It's one thing to understand that there's a need, it's another thing to identify the need, it's yet a third thing which requires time and effort to make the need get filled by matching people up. So.
It's all hard work.
It's all hard work.
Right. But with a lot of rewards. So, in the interest of time, I talked about PIPA's origins. And the first project was this case with the Peruvian maca, and I just talked to Jorge Goldstein and Stern Kessler, who was our first official volunteer, who is actually sent his regrets. A lot of people sent regrets, couldn't be here, but he actually, they have, they're close to a private settlement of that. There was an opposition to a patent on maca, which is a Peruvian root, which is used as for virility, and so they worked on opposing the patent in the U.S. With reexamination, and then that has led to apparently the owner of the patent was bought, and there are negotiations which I think may have concluded for, again, a private settlement of the dispute, which would, because the new owner was more concerned about the public interest implications. So, let's see. So, today, zooming down to the highly leveraged virtual volunteer organizations, what PIPA is today, and the future is something we're going to talk about later. But it clearly depends on continued interest and, by volunteers and at least some level of funding adequate to form the nucleus and the core to keep the volunteers connected. We're looking, again, for regional offices, professional staff, a broader donor base. An endowment would be nice at some point, but mainly a continued commitment to delivering IP. Services to people who need it. A couple of examples. This is one for a group called COFTA that was coordinated by a fair trade organization called Light Years IP. An opposition was filed through PIPA's help against an English organization that wanted to get a trademark registration on Kikoi, which is a generic term for a clock from Kenya, and so a pro bono lawyer there filed an opposition, and that resulted in the trademark application being blocked, so that leaving open the ability to export this cloth to England. and we'll talk about some more examples later. Another one was a group, well, and this is also a Kenyan case, of a group of women who made little models of VWs using discarded auto tires and metal coat hangers and things, and they were sold in the tourist trade, and VW, Volkswagen company, sent them a cease and desist letter to stop doing that, and through a PIPA attorney, they were able to respond and ultimately find a happy resolution where Volkswagen became very supportive and actually helped this organization. There are, Ben will talk about the World Health Organization initiative. Josh can talk a bit about the Peruvian bilateral free trade agreement, talking about disclosure of origin requirements. And let me toggle through our survey briefly. Okay, so in 2006, PIPA conducted a survey. It took about a year with a series of questions about what the needs were for intellectual property services in developing countries. Principle being, ask people, especially people who should know, what the actual needs are, rather than, at the time, there was a lot of policy discussion about what people should be concerned about, access to medicines being probably the primary topic of international discussion. And so here's just a few slides that show some data. We asked which types of organizations were responding, and so those who responded were, we had a lot of professional service organizations responding. That's no surprise because that's the constituency includes a lot of volunteers. We had academic institutions, research institutions, a number of individuals, small amount of philanthropic organizations, international organizations, developing country organizations. We said, what sectors would, which sectors would help be most important? And these are health, agriculture, biodiversity, technology, academic work, a fair amount of information technology, and trade. Less politics, some culture and art. What types of organizations need help? Academic institutions were very high, research institutions, developing country agencies, and small businesses, which was sort of a questionable component of PIPA's mandate. We were thinking primarily along the lines of nonprofits. What types of intellectual property services required? Patents, very high. Traditional knowledge, very high. Biological materials, copyrights, trademarks, and you're looking at folklore, trade secrets, and otherwise. Advice was very high. Licensing, very high, which is transactional. And training were very high, as well as obtaining IP rights. And so you see developing country interest in obtaining IP rights instead of just opposing IP laws and IP systems. I mean, you have one of the lessons from all this for me is creative people and innovative communities are found all over the world. And people want to put their ideas to work. So we compared the project that PIPA had at the time with what people were saying as a reality check to see if what the PIPA respondents were saying was consistent with the requests PIPA was getting. And no, not so much. I mean, there was a lot of talk about patents, but not as much in terms of PIPA projects. Advice regarding IP rights, high, and yes, that was advice was counseling. It's one of the main roles of PIPA volunteers. And copyright and trademarks are substantial, but not as high. Traditional knowledge, biological materials, and so on. So you see, and I won't go into much detail, the survey was skewed towards those who access email and the internet with less on-the-ground personal interviewing. We didn't have the resources to do that. That was the subject of our grant request to the UK Department for International Development for follow-on funding, but they decided to get out of the funding business. At first we thought it was just us, but then they got out of it altogether. So, but the summary is that we were surprised to see that there were there was a big need, and we've seen in our cases, on sort of trademarks, copyright, crafts, and actual protecting the innovative works of people in developing countries, which is exactly the opposite from what the policy folks were saying, which is, you know, break intellectual property down and try and get access, which is important in some cases too, but that's not what people are coming to PIPA for. Academic research institutions make sense. They're sort of centers of learning and expertise in developing countries, and small businesses as well. The lowest needs that were perceived at the time were litigation, mediation, invalidity and freedom to operate opinions, and performance rights, although we've had a few cases since then dealing with performance and so on.
Michael, before you move on, I want to interrogate one of the things you said, which is to what extent, if any, can you say that the needs are domestically focused in those countries or focused on activities that would occur outside the country? So, again, many of the examples are all about assuring that they can export to Kenya and other people don't assert rights against them in England,
right,
versus acquiring rights in Kenya, trying to license in Kenya or doing other things. So how much of this is foreign work that PIPA engages on behalf of foreign clients, but the foreigns are different foreign?
Right.
Or how much of it is U.S.-based?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the we haven't really categorized it carefully, but I would say that a great bulk of the work is, well, all of it originates in impacts developing country organizations in the country, but a lot of it is focused not necessarily to the U.S., but to the richer countries, because basically, a lot of this is economically driven or economically motivated and involves trying to protect the export from the developing country. The Yirgacheffe coffee example, the Ethiopian coffee growers and so on, is to protect the ability of the developing country innovators and entrepreneurs to penetrate the wealthier countries. So, That's very important. But there's also the opposite side of where developing country companies and so on are exerting force in the domestic country. Now, what would be a real sign of maturation is when you have, and I think there are some cases, now I have to think about examples of where it's in country,
right?
Yeah. And I think that's more and more the trend over the years.
Sure.
So I don't want to take up any more time, really. Because there's a lot of folks to talk about. I do want to talk about the other part of what PIPA does, which is, yes, the practice is the core, but there's a lot of training and theory that goes just into the practice. We've, from the very beginning, had training materials and an effort to collect them and provide knowledge base. The PIPA model involves sort of apprenticeships or teams of people. Developed country, experienced and inexperienced. The same volunteer could be in their country a provider of services in one area, but an assistance seeker in another area, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the current PIPA's most substantial current project is to conclude this board study on future scenarios for IP and human development, and that was written by the PIPA network of leading thinkers and writers, academics and practitioners on the literature of and volunteer students and other researchers on what was written about the different directions intellectual property could go and what the implications would be for different parts of society. Fair amount written in the developed world, but not so much in the developing world. And that book will be published with Ford's support by Cambridge University Press. Should be the end of this year. But it's an example of sort of a mob, mob written, mob reviewed through the PIPA network. And it does set sort of a model for a Web 2.0 PIPA which the website now is very old and stale, being 5 years, 7 years old, and doesn't even work on some platforms, and we need to renovate that. But one model is that you have sort of a wiki approach of the PIPA practitioners who can comment on and quickly get to the gist of an issue and share experience and so forth.
And the good news is technology can help to reduce the mediation costs for all of these wonderful volunteers.
Yeah. So I guess concluding thought before we go on is that there's a lot of great work being done by many people around the world, many in this room, much of it sort of solo or independent, and hopefully through that kind of using technology and having the global footprint, that there will be a resource for the individual efforts that people are doing to volunteer and to promote the public interest to come together. So.
So I'll pick up focusing more on the domestic side, although, as Michael has said, our IP clinic has helped out on two international projects. One was providing an analysis of the conformity of domestic laws that would require disclosures of origin in their patent system of where genetic resources came from that were the subject of subsequent patentable invention applications. That required, obviously, analyzing a wide range of existing international treaties. It had relevance both in the context of free trade agreements and also potentially the broader debate that's currently going on about access and benefit sharing in the context of conventional biological diversity. The WTO under the TRIPS agreement, since there's now a disclosure of origin proposal to amend TRIPS and others. The other project that we did was at the request of Sierra Leone. We did a similar policy analysis of what the TRIPS agreement does and doesn't require in order to become TRIPS compliant, because that's, a highly contentious area of particularly in the context of free trade agreements, again, where what is TRIPS Plus and what is not TRIPS Plus has been highly contested. Following that up, we also did a training by telecast. Again, technology is a wonderful way for reducing costs to train some judges and government officials in Sierra Leone. So there are many things that one can do internationally, but most of what we do in the IP clinic at American is domestically focused, and there's a huge unmet need for domestic IP services from a wide range of individuals and businesses, whether they're non-profit organizations per se, or people who are creating their own businesses and simply don't have the wherewithal to hire lawyers in the general market for legal services, and therefore won't move forward with what they do, or will do so in a way that is legally inadequate and can be helped. So I'll just give you a few examples to get a sense for the need again, and bringing it back to, although there is a network now, a growing network of IP clinics, and an existing network of transactional clinics that sometimes do pro bono IP work, and I'll come back to that at the very end. There's a much greater need out there than those clinics can serve. The amount of creative activity in this economy is massive. People are making decisions without legal advice all the time, and therefore there is a real function to be served for anyone listening and all of their friends to get involved. And the real question is how do you hook up with the clients? And of course, it can also be a business development opportunity. Want to think of it that way, because you get your name out and you start doing good things, people hear about it. So, where do the clients come from? What kinds of issues are there? They come from all over. We have on the copyright side, for example, both owners of rights or people who would like to acquire rights. Fortunately for copyrights, it's very easy to acquire your rights. You just have to fix it through creative expression in some type of tangible medium. So we represent people who have had photographs. We've represented people who have done music, whether they're well-known or not well-known. And, you know, there, other people sample their music. Other people have used their photographs in various ways. Those may be licensing questions. They might ultimately be litigation issues. Conversely, we also represent users of all stripes and sizes, which are more our particular favorites. Our documentary filmmakers, we represent lots of them and give them fair use advice, negotiate to gain the required permissions from decision makers, whether they're insurers who you need the insurance to be able to get into some festival or to just have the security that you're going to be able to distribute your works to people who actually control whether you'll enter into a particular venue, things like Sundance and other type of places. Again, the premise here is wherever there's creativity, there's a need for IP rights. Trademark side, again, we apply for and register trademarks on behalf of individuals who are starting up and then need to think about who's going to hold the trademark. Are they going to own it personally? Is it going to be some organization they're trying to found, haven't done so? And that triggers, again, the need for not just IP counseling, but basic business transactional law counseling. We apply for marks for these people. We counsel them on how they can use their marks, how their positions have changed. We license for them. We can talk to them about disputes that they get into, whether they're internet-based or whether they're based on products that are out in the world. There are a number of issues that we've dealt with dealing with collective marks and the need for or the failures of people to release their collective marks. Lots of different opportunities because, again, there are lots of different businesses and business models out there. So the need for these services is great. And, again, these are things that any creative actor will encounter. When we engage these businesses, we may represent them for one thing, but they certainly have other needs as well. So almost every nonprofit organization has policies that they need to think about. They have IP policies. What do they own and what are they doing with them? They have employee policies. Who in their organization will own whatever creative rights are generated in their activities? They have websites. What kind of web policies do they have? Do they have a DMCA agent? Do they have terms of use on their website? All sorts of issues that can and do routinely come up. These organizations don't have the money to pay $200 if they're lucky and $600 if they're Michael an hour for really high quality legal services. What else? Patents. I can't tell you the number of people who have what they think is a great idea and either need to be told that although it is a great idea, it isn't patentable, or it is patentable and even though you think it's a great idea, you haven't yet figured out or shown us that there's any reason why you need the patent to go forward, or if you do go forward with it, that anybody's actually going to want to use the invention and therefore it has no value. Those are things that lawyers can do. Again, those types of evaluations come at a price, and typically what happens, or what frequently happens, is because of the high price of legal services, there are these late-night TV shows, and people will go to the people on the late-night TV shows and get low-quality services, if they get the services they're contracted for at all. Some may actually do a good job, so I'm not trying to cast broad aspersions, but the premise is it's low cost. That's why they'll go there, because they can't afford the high-quality legal services that large firms and even small firms can provide. That's why there is a tremendous pro bono need in this area. But there's lots of other stuff about patents that anyone who is going into business needs to think about. Freedom to operate agreements. Increasingly, re-examination requests to try to knock out patents that are potentially blocking you. TK protection, a whole other area. What does one do in TK? And again, depending on how one defines traditional, there's lots of traditional knowledge in the United States as well as around the world. We were talking about yesterday there is an indigenous form of music within Washington, D.C. called go-go. Unfortunately, I don't know as much about it as I'd like to. But that's something that could potentially be protected. There are both offensive needs How does one assert, acquire and assert rights to the traditional knowledge? The other is defensive needs. How do you prevent people from acquiring benefits of the traditional knowledge without crediting it adequately? So all kinds of attribution issues. Without providing benefits, so that's where the genetic resource issues typically come in. But again, wide ranges of unserved legal needs or underserved legal needs for which pro bono assistance is needed. The last thing, as I said, I was going to mention is the relationship to the transactional clinics. Again, if you think about this, these are what one would say are prudent business legal needs or business-related legal needs, whether they're individuals who are going into business or whether they're nonprofits or other collectives who want to think through their legal and business strategy together. And there's a difficulty about how you separate the expertise. And one of the things that came up in particular in regard to the IP and Transactional Clinics Conference yesterday was the self-definition problem and the expertise problem, because if you define a problem in a particular way, the clients may not come to you for the advice even though they need it. Conversely, even if you define yourself broadly, you will quickly find yourself pushed, because of the nature of the needs, to try to address or incorporate or find or otherwise associate with the expertise needed to manage all of the legal needs that any particular business or creative person has. So the one thing I would say is, although PIPA is the public interest intellectual property advisors, we need to think about serving the intellectual property advisor need more broadly than just by providing intellectual property legal advice, but also to incorporate and find ways to associate pro bono volunteers on these business planning, corporate formation, and other types of legal services needs, all which of which may be triggered by either a core model where the business is premised upon the IP, or a core model where the business is not premised upon IP, but you necessarily generate important IP in the process and need to find ways to manage it. So, why don't we turn it over to some of you to join us in the discussion? I'm going to circulate microphones. So if the people who want to come down to present, that's fine. If anybody wants to chime in with questions, use these microphones for the questions. And the people who we ask to come down so you can be on the video camera. Great.
And Josh, let me interrogate you, as you said, on your point. Question being, what is the meaning of pro bono? What is the public interest? Among all those needs that you cite, those are present in well-heeled organizations, individuals, and so on. What is your cut for those who qualify for clinical services, you know, pro bono services from your side versus those who don't?
So every clinic may have a different policy about this. We at Washington College of Law, I'll just tell you, our policy is very simply, we're not competing with the practicing bar. If people can afford it, they should go there. But what does it mean to be able to afford these kinds of legal services? Well, if you are a struggling organization, or even if you're not a struggling organization, very often you will simply forego the high cost of legal services because you have higher priority needs. If you simply are not going to pay the money in the market for those kinds of legal services, we will take it. If you are going to do it, you should go ahead and do it and go elsewhere, unless in doing so you can convince us that it will so impact the other things that you need that it really is worth our efforts to facilitate what you're doing, because really what you're doing is you're paying, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Some other clinics have actual income thresholds and therefore can only service clients who are below the poverty line or some percentage above the poverty line. Again, these are questions of clinic formation. Some clinics will not serve for-profit entities. Some clinics will only serve nonprofits below an income level or having certain activity thresholds. Again, what I'm trying to say is, leaving the clinic network aside, there are a whole range of volunteers out there, and the short premise is these organizations are not going to acquire the legal services in the group. then we are not in competition with the practicing bar for these activities. That's where the need comes in our mind.
Well, and that's it. And let's, I don't know if Chuck, you want to go next, but I mean, the important lesson from that, I think, is that if you have an excess supply of volunteers and a lower demand for people who fit your qualification for pro bono clients, then maybe we should change the criteria, which sounds like you have looser criteria than as far as who the clients are. And Fred, I think, can comment on that as well.
Do you want to grab the mic?
So you, why don't you comment on that, Fred?
Let me just come back.
If you want to
sit down where I was for now.
Oh, okay.
I'll move back. Chuck has a couple slides too, so we need to get him access up here. But go ahead.
My name is Fred Fragoni. I run a program called the Center for New Technology Enterprise. It's an independent, nonprofit, web-based educational organization, which is truly multidisciplinary. And we provide not only a broad array of IP and business legal services, but we also provide non-legal services such as assistance with business plans, competitive analyses, research, valuation, and so, regulatory assistance, and so on. I've never run a program that has an income limitation, and it seems to me that and our model not only does not compete with the bar or other professional service providers, it actually uses them as volunteers and mentors. So, for example, we will not take on a client that has a legal matter, for example, unless we also find one or more law firms, depending upon the client's needs, that are willing to work with that client and with us to be able to provide the supervision and mentorship that both the client and the student groups require. So that I think that there are ways to get around this, I think, perceived issue of competition. In fact, I formed the New York State Science and Technology Law Center a number of years ago, and that was the model that we used, and we actually found that the bar was extremely supportive. We had a network of well over 50 law firms in New York State that were very, very happy to work with our students and our clients. So that I think if you're dealing with early stage companies, and you exclude from your service base things like interface with the SEC or other matters where, frankly, a pro bono or limited fee organization should not be involved, I think that you can actually find that the professional service provider community not only doesn't feel slighted, but actually can be very supportive.
I want to just briefly introduce the
intellectual property nonprofit organization, Legal Clinic at Washington University, and in so doing, refer to a couple of articles that frame the public interest issue, I think, as it needs to be framed. This article by Tony Lupino, that many of you met yesterday, has done a survey of the economic development and small business clinics, citing about 48 law schools in the United States that currently operate such clinics, and then using our listserv for IP clinics, there are at least another 24 U.S. and Canadian law schools that have IP clinics, but there's considerable overlap, about 14 schools in which you find both IP and economic development or small business clinics. And the self-identified IP clients seem to be serving two distinct missions. And here I'll use the two articles, one by Josh and Company, Clinical Education and the Public Interest in Intellectual Property, and my own companion to Michael Gollin's article, Answering the Call of Intellectual Property and Then Business Formation, Legal Clinic at WashU. Whereas Josh has indicated his clinic focuses both on representing users and on giving underserved communities access to intellectual property legal services. Our clinic is primarily concerned with the latter, and we do a good bit of international work. And they do have distinct missions. Since an awful lot of user representation involves litigation, but getting access involves advice and administrative work. Distinct skill sets, I think, arise through the mission that the university clinic chooses to follow. Our clinic is not a walk-in clinic. It's based on four different program areas: interdisciplinary innovation within the university, business incubation within the community, pro bono IP work, which includes both local volunteer lawyers for the arts referrals and also PIPA referrals, and finally, international botanical research and economic development that I'll explain in more detail due to the location in St. Louis of two important international research organizations. Here's our clinic with our clinic coordinator, David Deal, who's a registered patent attorney. We also have Peter Ruger, who's a retired Washington University General Counsel, who's a nonprofit organization specialist. So that gives our clinic twofold capability, and it's now the largest and most popular clinic in the law school with 12 students per semester, 8 IP and 4 nonprofits organizations. We require considerable prerequisites before a student gets into the clinic. They're required to attend class 3 hours a week and spend 14 to 20 hours with client contact. A couple of examples. In interdisciplinary innovation, we helped a project called the Blessing Basket Project that contracts basket weavers from four of the poorest countries in the world. Teresa Wilson, the founder, has got a distribution contract with Whole Foods and pays her weavers what she calls prosperity wages, and we're in fact working on a possible certification mark for the phrase prosperity wages. Business incubation, our clinic students work with two business incubators in town, the Knight Center for Scientific Enterprise, which is primarily biotech, and the Center for Emerging Technologies, where what we mainly do there is provide training units for startups and individual innovators. We found that legal clinics really work on the same of legal education and legal representation, and giving startup clients a quick and easy legal education is a critical function of our clinic. This is the NIGAS Center, and this is the Center for Emerging Technology. Our pro bono representation includes working with St. Louis volunteer lawyers and accountants for the arts. And here's one of our most successful projects when our young, ambitious law student, Toby Buloff, after 5 years of searching copyrights for obscure gospel songs, the Kennerley Temple Choir finally resorted to us. And in 2 months, Toby got them 17 copyright permissions so they could put out their CD for their 50th anniversary CD that they wanted to distribute. And finally, and this gets to the question of how to generate international clients. We found that one of our most useful connections has been through the Missouri Botanical Garden, which is not only a beautiful botanical garden, but is a world research leader in botanical research. And it is through their work that we have developed our international contacts. For example, the Missouri Botanical Garden is a partner in a new entity funded by the NIH, by the way, called the International Center for Indigenous Phytotherapy Studies in South Africa. And that entity will work closely with traditional healers. This is our clinic director, David Deal, talking to a traditional healer in South Africa. And out of this collaboration grew another collaboration in Madagascar, where the Missouri Botanical Garden also does botanical research. The problem they have, there are disappearing forest preserves, and the reason the preserves are disappearing in part is that Madagascar is cyclone prone, and every time a cyclone comes through and wipes out the subsistence agriculture of the villages around the forest preserve, the only backup economy the villagers have is to make charcoal for cooking fuel out of the rainforest. So when the Missouri Botanical Garden came to the clinic and started presenting the problem that they had, I noticed very quickly into their PowerPoint presentation a number of woven objects that were involved. Apparently there were talented weavers, basket weavers, in the villages. And as a result, the village women around that forest preserve now earn prosperity wages because it's their baskets, among others, that are being distributed by the Blessing Basket Project. Here's one of the Missouri Botanical Garden researchers with a village woman doing one of the baskets that you can purchase at Whole Foods or at the garden gift shop. And out of that initial contact, we now have an interdisciplinary Madagascar course in which we send a team of students, law, business, and social work students, to track the impact of these prosperity wages on the villages to make sure that we're not too disruptive in what we're introducing into the community and that we deal with the social issues that might arise as a result of that. Here, our last delegation to Madagascar, this past spring's delegation got derailed by political instability, but we have sent a team with our clinical director over to Madagascar. And they are here talking with the villagers about various natural resources. Now that we've dealt with the baskets, we're now looking to see what traditional knowledge villagers have about the botanical resources to see what development possibilities there are there. So that's my quick and easy overview of our clinic. I would welcome any communications from any of you about our activity.
Great. Thanks a lot. A great story. And one of the points that came out last night was, and this is true whether you're representing paying clients or volunteering to represent clients, is it's hard to find good clients, and once you find good clients, you want to work with them. And that's a great example of how you found this community in Madagascar and then just built on that to help them and bring them up and providing a lot of education and both for the students and for the clients. Why don't we take any other comments at the moment? And meanwhile, I think Rita and Ben and Joan, if you could maybe in that order give your remarks, but we should pause for any questions from anybody else or comments on what has been said so far. Anybody? What? Rita, are you ready to go?
Why don't you come down?
Okay.
That we can view you on the webcast.
So Rita Khanna is the general counsel at ARIS Foundation, which is a Gates-funded TB
vaccine
company. Sorry, and has been on the board of PIPA for many years. And
okay, so I would begin with saying that, you know, this PIPA was your brainchild, so I don't know how the guts came in there, but I don't know, the heart is probably the network that you created, but now we need to keep it alive and growing. And
the guts are what sustained
right now, yes. Mm-hmm. So I think you've heard that how in today's world, globalizing world, the ability to utilize technology is critical for, you know, anywhere, everywhere in the world. And this is because, you know, most of the technologies that were developed is the developed world, and how do we transfer those to developing countries? You need to have some kind of a knowledge on the other side where they can have make a fair deal, what would be sort of, you know, a balanced deal. Now, we know that a lot of the germplasm and the biodiversity or the natural products, the resources were in the developing countries. So they're a little bit wary of the fact that how in the past things didn't go their way. People have taken things from there and then come and file patents. So there's a distrust there. And more recently, they themselves are innovating. So people comes into play in, you know, sort of overcoming that imbalance. You know, how do we create that trust, and how do we get into this business of, you know, where the people are not knowledgeable about how to do these deals, how do we bring them up to speed, how do we help them? And as you've heard from Michael and others, that we do have a network. I think that's resources there, but we haven't gotten any funding for the last, now, how many years?
Well, depending on how you count funding, it's two or 3 years.
Yeah, we've had some funding, you know, very low level funding, and we've tried to sort of carrying on in a very low mode. Now, do we need to sit here and reflect? Is there something that we are not doing right? I think in this audience here, we've heard this convincingly, that the need is there. Why is it that our prospective donors, they don't recognize that, and they don't see, do they see that we, you know, there's no need for this role that people plays? Or are we going to the wrong people? I think Michael had mentioned yesterday that there was some reluctance on the part of people to go to the United States agencies to get funding, because that would perpetuate the idea, oh, here comes the big United States and they must have a motive. So you stayed away from that, but you've been able to get funding from, let's say, UK, also Rockefeller. I'd like to propose something and see how, you know, we can maybe discuss it and see pros and cons. Maybe people should consider forming some kind of a consortium, you know, bring in law firms, maybe bring in corporate businesses, pharmaceuticals, and they buy into this idea. Why would they buy into it? Because it gives them a better image. It also enhances their visibility, so maybe business, more business for them. And what would that mean? How much money do we need? I think the network is there to keep that network going, to maintain or to really get it going and working. We don't need that much money. So could we sort of come up with a consortium idea? That should be sort of like the short term. Long term could be that once we have a little bit more visibility, maybe we have a big donor like the Gates Foundation. They see, hey, here, this is something that's working, and it is being, meeting certain needs in the developing countries. And there are pros and cons. I mean, there may be some people think that, why DOFA might think that we have our own pro bono network that we do, but it's not so focused on IP or developing countries. Some firms are doing that, and we probably won't offer those. Or is there a reluctance that you just want to keep it just a few firms? You can list about 20 and see what kind of response we get. And I'd like to, you know, sort of have that in a discussion to see why, how we can do this. Why should we do it? If we do it, how would it be successful?
Good. Well, and I as to the factual question of how many law firms and so on, we've reached out to law firms. We have a lot of law firm volunteers, and there's been a lot of sort of interest. But I guess those who are experienced in business development or a development for nonprofits, which would exclude myself. I don't count myself as experienced or particularly successful in that. But interest is just the first step. And how you actually close that and make that into a real group, that's a challenge. It's a story we haven't told well enough.
Yeah, and I think the other component I would add to that is that to bring in the developing country governments, and I wouldn't be surprised if they would be willing to give some money in as we, because they will line up projects for us, and we show them here are the, you know, highly trained attorneys from reputable firms in the United States. where to get rid of the doubt that they might have, we should, on the consortium, we have representation from these countries.
Yeah.
I mean, bringing some people on the board, and you know, then there's more of a sort of a confidence into the, you know, what kind of help they would be getting. It won't be biased.
Okay, great, thanks. Ben, do you want to go ahead and talk about your experiences with PIPA and suggestions for the future?
Okay, well, basically, I'd like to follow up on Josh and Michael and Rita and Charles' prescient comments. I have just a few points, I think, to make my view clear. First of all, I want to give a little bit of background. I worked for 4 years in Lyon, France, and for two of those years, I was helping to manage a large life sciences meeting, and for two of those years, I was working with PIPA and other organizations as a private consultant to work with through UN organizations and other organizations, mainly Europe-based, to try to further the goals of PIPA. I think that particularly in light of some of Rita's thoughtful comments, I think it's very important that we continue the core function of PIPA, which is, in fact, matchmaking. And in order to do that effectively with the very low budget that we have, it essentially means keeping the database that we have intact of the volunteers and all of the people that are so willing to help us. But also, I think it may mean leveraging the many volunteers that we have that are primarily younger people that have desire and the energy to do some very useful things for PIPA, in the sense that they can be sort of the pioneers for PIPA in developing countries. Where we want to get eventually, I think, in my view, is that we want to have a series of placements, so to speak, in a few areas of the world where PIPA could be represented. Now, of course, that's highly ambitious considering that our funding needs at this point, but I think it's important to have a sort of a vision and not be just looking at the funding, which, of course, we must do. But in addition to that, we have to have a vision so that once the funding does come, we know where we want to go. I think also that we need to target the awareness of intellectual property and the need. You know, we've heard over and over again that there is this lack of awareness on the part of the potential funders and others of the even the basic need for intellectual property in developing countries. And I think that the way that we can target that awareness is to put it toward the policymakers who, paraphrasing a former president, are the deciders. They are the people who are out there and deciding what is going to be the next step in many, many ways, but in terms of intellectual property, what are the guiding forces and what things should be supported and not supported. So if we can, you know, as we ramp up from where we are, I think it's important that we get the message out to the people who are making those kinds of the policy decisions. The publications and newsletters help as that is possible. I plan to work with the former CEO, I guess you'd call him, Steve Price of PIPA, to complete a publication on the work, some of the work that Michael was just showing, a survey of intellectual property needs in developing countries. Now, that survey is interesting. I want to say one comment about it, because it is actually something from the developing countries saying, this is what we are, here are our opinions, this is what we need. And we aren't aware, I think, Michael, of any other source for that kind of information. So it's really a unique thing that should be shared widely. I also think that PIPA is well positioned for a booster shot, so to speak, now. People, after 5 or 6 years, are used to hearing the name PIPA And when we do our outreach, as it were, I think that there will be an increasing awareness of what we are doing, and therefore that will help the organization to thrive. I think I'm going to leave just one more comment that I feel strongly about, and that is that we should do a better job of working with all of the organizations that are invested in this area of intellectual property capacity building for developing countries, so that we can, you know, there is, in my view, indeed a strength in numbers. So we have, you know, probably, I don't know, half a dozen just NGOs that are primarily working in the area of intellectual property that could be said to be have some relation to PIPA. And if we work with those groups and perhaps eventually seek funding as with two or three of the organizations working in conjunction, I think our chances for that funding will be even better. And that's pretty much what I have.
Great, thanks. And so I should point out that PIPA is not just lawyers, just to state the obvious to some people, but not so obvious to others. It includes IP professionals, which is a much broader swath. And at this table, you have an example of all three PhDs, right?
PhD. Yep.
Yeah. So PhDs or lawyers is generally true because we have here are three PhDs, one a lawyer, one a student, and one IP tech transfer practitioner.
Yeah. And that means we can tell lawyer jokes.
Well,
of course. Why did they bury lawyer 6 feet underground?
I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Why did they bury lawyer 12 feet underground?
Why?
Because deep down, they're really nice people.
All right, on that note. Jackson has had a distinguished research career and then went to law school and was PIPA's first, I guess, full-time intern last summer. So Joan, why don't you say a few words?
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Rita, and thank you, Ben, for giving me the opportunity to learn so much last summer. My job on this agenda is to kind of appeal to the non-barred group or the pre-barred group to show the tremendous benefits to those persons who would volunteer as pre-barred law students, and also to the benefits that you can afford to the overseas investigators. As a former 30-year investigator, I identify with the birds. We tend to get so involved in our creative endeavors that we don't see the wave coming in to hit us in the intellectual property. I think that's typical of most. It was typical in our case, and the assistant seekers I've talked to from PIPA also have voiced those concerns. It's a kind of a crisis management situation. And now I'd like to go through a little bit of what life is like as a PIPA intern. Some of the things that a PIPA intern will do, which will carry over directly into your law practice, is you do a lot of routine business drafting. Of correspondence, of business procedures that you will need in your law practice. So all of that will carry over when you leave PIPA. The most important thing, and this was the thing that Dr. Sarnoff addressed, is the matchmaking. And as he brought forward, the most important thing that you do in the matchmaking is to link the proper assistance seeker up with the proper attorney. And this is a very delicate operation. you're not alone. with the group of the PIPA board, you will never get your head chopped off, unlike some situations in law school. as Josh brought out, it's a very delicate operation. The process itself, and I'll go through the mechanics a little bit because nobody has yet addressed that. On the website, there's a form that the assistant seekers fill out, and they check the box and they say whether they think it's a patent issue or a copyright issue or a trademark issue. But as a scientist, you know that they don't know what they're talking about. They have no conception of what a trademark is or what a copyright is. So you take all that with a grain of salt. And then there's a little paragraph at the bottom that says, well, why are you contacting PIPA? And that's your key, is that paragraph, why are you contacting PIPA? You read that very, very carefully. And sometimes you can get the gist of what they're talking about, and sometimes you can't. And you'll have to call them up or contact them again by email to get more information. And then there's times like the hamster issue here where you get something in the email that comes over the internet as Arabic. I don't know how many of you speak Arabic or read Arabic, but I don't. And that's when you have to know something about your IP network. And that's where Michael comes in, and he tells me, okay, look in this law firm, look in that law firm, and you'll find an Arabic speaker. And in fact, we handled all these things. And we did a fairly good job of finding people to address each problem from each assistance seeker, no matter what form they sent us. And we were able to find people with the very expertise that these assistance seekers required with the proper referrals to the people on the network. And as Michael said, there's 1,000 people on this network. They're all over in countries all over the world. They speak every language that most assistance seekers will be likely to come in. They have expertise in individual parts of the law where they're the top professionals in their field. It's a delight to learn from these people. They're the top people in the world. You couldn't have a better schooling education than PIPA can provide as a volunteer. The other thing that you do as a PIPA volunteer is you help Michael and Rita and Ben and the board look for funding. And I came into this with being moderately successful in getting grants in science, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a piece of cake. 3 months later, we hadn't even gotten in the front door of these people. And so it is not an easy thing, as Rita has pointed out, and it's a very difficult thing. But it's something that a PIPA volunteer might be able to not be afraid to put forth their own ideas, because it's thinking outside the box that may be the key to getting our funding in the future. And finally, it's about apologies to Jonathan Livingston Siegel, facilitating the assistance seeker's success. And this has important ramifications for the economies of developing countries, because without the economic benefits of their intellectual property protection, as Dr. McManus pointed out, they haven't got a chance for becoming anything other than a developing country. And I'm a student, Second Life, and that's my contact information. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Joan. And
Joan,
go ahead.
Another thing that a student gets is Michael's book, Arba.
Of course. Joan was fantastic last summer, and the enthusiasm and the energy was really crucial. And that's really what I think keeps the organization alive, is that we just get one after another and hopefully, you know, more groups of people at a time who just say, this is a great organization. What a great model. What a great group. What great success. And Joan's story there about how she worked heroically and creatively and diligently towards identifying those groups who should be funding the philanthropies. And it really, I mean, as an empirical, as an empiricist, that was a very well-run experiment, and the results were pretty clear that they were not interested at that level. So it's a whole, which is one of the questions today, and hopefully we can get some answers, are what are those other creative ideas, and is there a more sustained or different way to go about making the case? Ben, I also would like you, if you would, just to say briefly to summarize the WHO TRIPS project that you coordinated, which was another one of those examples of PIPA being really important and the kind of the weight of the world falling on PIPA's shoulders. So if you could just summarize that.
When you, are you talking about
the landscape? Yeah, the WIPO.
That's more a WIPO.
The WIPO, World Health Organization, patent landscape.
That's right. So the World Intellectual Property Organization wanted to do a patent landscape on the H5N1 virus and see where the intellectual property was and what state that was in, so that they could then assist the World Health Organization mainly through what is now called the IGWIG, or International Working Group on Public Health and Innovation in Intellectual Property. That's quite a mouthful, but nevertheless, that's the group of international organizations that's the group through which international organizations can speak in hand in hand with the WHO to have an impact on the many issues surrounding health. So what we did was we went through and surveyed the literature, the patent literature, and the regular literature to some extent to determine where we were in terms of intellectual property related to the H5N1 virus. And it turns out that we are very early in that process, mainly because it takes some time for these patents to mature. So when you do a search on these patents, you find that there are many patents filed, but few that have been actually matured into U.S. patents or international patents. And so we have a report on that that's available on the WIPO website, and PIPA was a very important part of that. I was coordinating with several PIPA volunteers to make that happen, and that recently has come to completion. I think it was a good way for the kind of work that PIPA has traditionally done to be bridged with the more, I shouldn't say more substantive, but more very important work that goes on in some of these international organizations that can use just the kinds of skills that PIPA volunteers have. And that's pretty much where that is right now.
And just to clarify for those of us who don't remember what H5N1 is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So this is the avian flu.
The avian flu.
And the reason that it's important to understand the patent landscape for that virus is for vaccine research, or is it for drug development, or for both, or something else?
I think it's really for both, because the vaccine research has to take place in a space that allows the public access, especially in developing countries, to potential vaccines or other treatments for avian flu. And there are predictions by some scientists that this is a potential epidemic that would result in not millions, but population die-off is the kind of terms they like to use. And that's a kind of a scary term. But, you know, we're sitting right now in a convenient time when no massive numbers of people have been subjected to, have died from the virus. However, there's some potential that something like the 1918 flu pandemic could recur with some form of this virus. So it's very important to remove intellectual property barriers from the landscape, as it were, of things that can prevent new treatments and availability of viral strains to researchers and to basically benefit the public in the longer run.
Was there any process for removing the barriers or just identifying what IP exists right now?
Right now, all we're trying to do is identify the IP that exists so that we can educate policymakers through the WHO and in any other channels that we could use so that they can use that information and kind of really eliminate some of the noise which has so far characterized the WHO groups. It used to be something called the Commission on Intellectual Property and Health, and now it's this other thing called IGWIG. But traditionally, a lot of the basically hundreds of organizations would come in with comments, and the real difficulty for them is that both WHO and WIPO are, of course, intergovernmental organizations. So that when the public sector and the civil society, if you will, comes in, you're going to have sort of a cacophony of opinions. And so the effort through WIPO that we were involved in is one that seeks to provide some reliable information on the intellectual property aspects.
And if I may, I think the political context was such that here you had all this theory and discussion about the politics and the policies, and I find it extremely telling that these two huge and important organizations came to PIPA for PIPA's credibility and the ability to have a public interest-oriented network of volunteers around the world to provide a factual record of what the current patent landscape was on the topic. And, you know, there are the giants and there's little PIPA. And I thought that was really very interesting about the model.
Yeah, my question relates to actually this project. They came to PIPA because it was going to be more economical for them.
They could afford the studies. It was really.
I'm not so sure. But I'm saying, so maybe you can serve that niche. You know, there are a lot of nonprofits here, like TB Vaccine Foundation, MVI. I mean, there are 15 of those. Could we create that kind of niche? Because they are working on developing country diseases, as we, you know. So is that something to consider to get that higher visibility? And then once we reach that stage, we can slowly wean these off? Because we do know that these foundations have money, just like you gave an example of Viapol, they did have the money.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
Yeah. So relatively typically speaking, foundations, you know, of course, those who are in the medical research area, they're willing to spend on IP, but I know another foundation that's doing education of women in Africa and other countries. IP is not their main thing, but I get calls from them saying, what should we do? We know these things are very expensive. We don't have the resources. Is that a niche that we could serve, you know? And as long as it connects us to developing countries, even though they're based here?
Yeah. So I think it's all on the table as far as, and I think this comes through expanding the client base. Mm-hmm. If we heard the story last night about a lawyer at Clark Modé in Peru who was trying to help organize some craftspeople, potters in a particular village, and went out there on her motorcycle and called them out to form together a legal entity to file to protect the geographical indicator, a geographical designation for that pottery. And you know, I think you need that level of field work to identify the real, you know, the real grassroots folks. And that's one level of effort. But the other is to do what you're talking about and what the WHO WIPO initiative talks about, is to expand the client base. Josh made the point too. Where you have people who would be happy probably to do volunteer work for an organization which are debatably could pay for the services, but is a public interest organization in and of itself. If the volunteers are there willing to help, why not? I think that's
yeah, and part so they could pay part, so it's not a full fee, just like you did for WIPO.
Right, and it covers expenses and so on.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like
June, and then the gentleman over there.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to
be
talking about bird flu here, so just a couple of maybe non sequiturs. It's called bird flu because it's in birds, and what people in the human health arena forget is that those of us in agriculture have been working on this for decades. In fact, one of our scientists has now become world famous, and I can tell you for sure that USDA doesn't have any patent rights on it. I'm just thinking, to the extent that you stay involved in this project and patents become an impediment anyway, I believe there are a lot of agricultural scientists that might be able to help with prior art and reexaminations and so on. The other thing that this raises is other sorts of property rights that have been created under the CBD and for us the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources, because in the bird flu case, of course, countries, in particular Indonesia, wants to assert CBD rights over their isolates, which is kind of interesting because the agricultural scientists are sharing them amongst the other scientists, so there are ways to get them. But, I mean, this is, I think, some of these issues of access and benefit sharing agreements, and that kind of property right is going to be asserted more and more often and is part of the landscape here of property rights.
If I may just quickly, I want to take it back to the fact that we're talking about, on the one hand, PIPA being an organization that is a matchmaking organization, puts together basically individual clients in developing countries with appropriate resources, intellectual property resources. And on the other, these are more project-oriented of a different, fundamentally different nature. So as an organization, we need to keep that in mind and decide what kind of resources, as they become available to us, we wish to have on each side. I just wanted to say that.
Good. Okay. Questions or comments from the audience?
Hi.
Is this working? Okay.
There is a group called the Civilian Research Defense Foundation. It's funded by the NSF, and their job is to work with former Russian Federation scientists to develop ways for them to make some money. They actually have funded lots of small grants to those folks in Eastern European countries, and I'm sure that they might be interested in talking to you about your services. Part of the work that they're also doing now, in addition to making grants, is to help set up a basic business administration function for the scientists whose host institutions don't know anything about grants management or money management or things like that. The NIH has also started funding a group in Bamako, Mali, that as a function of helping scientists in Africa, and especially right now in Mali, with respect to their research enterprises and then the business part of their work. I also was wondering, maybe law students who you identified at the clinics and schools around the country might be willing to go to large scientific conferences and to advertise what PIPA is all about and just set up a table there. They can get arrangements to do that at low cost, perhaps. Just advertising, because you have big international conferences like ASM, American Society of Microbiology, or the Keystone Foundation conferences, you can touch a pretty big audience internationally with respect to their needs. At least advertise what you're up to.
So your point is that the scientists actually are sort of the honeybees that carry a lot of the knowledge about innovation in their countries to the international conferences, and that they can actually be good messengers.
Right. They have the need. I'm going to be an embassy science fellow in Croatia this fall. That's why I'm going to be interested. That's why I'm interested in what you're doing, besides the fact that I'm Joe's husband. So, and I know that the Eastern Europeans are very, very interested, and Croatia is a big regional center of science for some of the smaller countries in Eastern Europe. And they have a lot of need to do their training and their collaboration with other countries because they're small and they need to interact a lot. So international patent protection and tech transfer and interest of that are very high over there.
Should we take why don't we take a 5-minute break
and come back and start with the next group at noon? And then you want to talk? Go ahead and
I understood that our conference mission here was to look for the way forward, and I just wanted to pose some very specific suggestions for PIPA.
Why don't you hold this, because that'll be the beginning.
You want it in the next session?
Yeah.
Okay,
so
that'd be fine.
Wow, what a great teaser.
and more after this. Well,
but, right, but we will start up probably at noon. So.
Property rights
and
disaster.
Let me get started again.
So are you using your
shoes? No. Here we go. But you know, I need that. Sure. So we have three new panelists up here.
That's
my immediate right.
They'll understand.
Left is Mike Ryan, who is director of the Creative and Innovative Economy Center at George Washington. Next to him is Rick Reedy of the International Intellectual Property Institute. And next to him is Ashlyn Lembrey from the Franklin Pierce, I don't know the actual title, is it IP Law Clinic or?
It's a Franklin Pierce Law Center Intellectual Property and Transaction Clinic.
Yeah, that's about it. All right. So why don't we start with you, Michael, because I know that you're going to have to leave immediately. So, please.
Great, thank you. Well, it's very good to see. It's very good to see all of you, and I apologize. Saturday morning, 12 o'clock is my cutoff. We have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and they're at German class right now. And when they get back, I'm to be there, my wife says, if I'm not out of the country, which frequently I am. And that's going to be sort of the segue into talking about what I want to talk about. And I told Michael twice, actually, earlier when he asked me to speak here, I said, no, you don't want me to talk. And then even more recently, I said, no, you really don't want me to talk. But he really does. So let me introduce this by saying, I think of Michael as an old friend whom I've known a long time because I was on the faculty at Georgetown Business School and he was teaching a course then. In fact, you probably still do, for all I know, in intellectual property management for business students. And I actually am now at George Washington's law school, as opposed to the business school, but I have spent much of my time in the business school. And that maybe colors a couple of the ways about what I think, but in particular, it colors the way in which I've designed the center that I direct, one of these many centers with complicated names. The Creative and Innovative Economy Center. Language that was crafted despite its awkwardness, because if you say you're the Center for Intellectual Property and Economic Development, then people close doors. But if you say, what we're interested in is how to make your economy more creative and innovative, all doors are open. And the role that intellectual property plays then becomes a sort of subset of the conversation, rather than some blockage over some real or ideological issue. My center then has been for some number of years doing both research as well as educational programs. But going back to when PIPA was founded, Michael and I met and talked about it, and I'll say to you now what was true then, which is that I wasn't a big fan of the concept, and I've never actually been involved with PIPA all these years. And so I'm going to just bluntly tell you what my thinking was about all that and what my thinking remains. We've done lots of educational programs through the years. Already this year, we've done one in New Delhi, and we've done one in Sao Paulo. And last year, we did a bunch of different programs in East Africa, in Brazil and India also, and so done lots of programs. Among the things I think we need to focus on are, truly want you to question yourselves about the development of legal markets. It's very, very important, and I thought this when I was at business school, and I think about it more now that I'm in law school. Developing countries have every right to create legal markets themselves, too. And one of the things I noted by the time that Michael and I first met was that any time any event, whether I'd organized or somebody else organized it, in a developing country that was about intellectual property was that lots of local attorneys came. And to me, these were the people who were wanting to get business. They were wanting they were really interested in intellectual property and they wanted to turn it into a business for themselves, a little bit of a business, which is what it is for most people, or ultimately a big business. And I've always believed through the years that these people should be supported. And I've always tried to do what I could with our programs to make sure that they were invited, that they were given roles, et cetera. So that's kind of my first point about this, which is that I really think we have to focus on how local lawyers are a key marketplace. Now, here's where you can say about the local marketplace. The truth of the matter is, many of these lawyers in developing countries are not experienced enough. to be able to provide some of the kinds of services that are needed. And in this room, I don't need to tell you because you're all sophisticated about this stuff, but we would just summarize by saying if it's biomedical stuff like some of you do, local attorneys typically can't do it. They don't have enough experience in the minutiae of patent law in a particular area of science to do it. In which case, then, what's going to happen is what I've seen happen through the years, which is the development of a marketplace that's an international marketplace for legal services. If it's biomedically oriented, the people who are doing this probably have, A, the expertise to judge whether their own attorneys can do this work or not, and they usually decide they can't. And then they're going to do one of two strategies. They're either going to hire somebody locally, say, find me a Munich and Washington-based attorney to actually do the work, and you'll be the middleman, which is good if that happens because that means that there's knowledge and technology transfer, in a sense, going on between, let's say, Michael and the local attorney, right? That is the ideal one. I think that's the ideal relationship. Now, what I've also seen people do, I know people who skip over that step and just say, well, I'm going to be the one to decide who I want. And so, and by the way, if you think that's only in the wealthier countries like Brazil and India, my Jordanian friends in the biomedical business, they skip over. I can tell you they actually skip over, most of them that I know. They go right to Munich, they go right to Washington, Silicon Valley, they have their own attorneys, they recruit them themselves, da-da-da, right? Then that raises this issue. Okay, well, I was going to say the issue of trust. Hold that thought for a second. But then on trademark work, as we know, the trademark work can more likely be done by local attorneys and such at that level, but then it's probably also going to take some partnership with someone, here in Washington or in Europe or whatever for the international part. In which case, then, I say to you, what I end up having happening is that people hear about what we've been doing and such with these different educational programs, and they call me up. I mean law firms here. And they say, let's get together for lunch. And they say, you know, Brazil, Middle East, East Africa, you'd be surprised, but actually I have East Africa, where people said, we'd like to become involved. And in the East Africa case, by the way, this was, want to develop a long-term business strategy. This is legal services, right? This is a law office here. He said, East Africa is a part of our long-term strategy because, he said, we've got we're a small firm, we've got a hidden world of the ink kind of strategy. We know that the big people aren't there, they're all in China and India. So we're going to go for East Africa, and we know this will take time, but we're making money in our marketplace. So then they say, is there any way you can help? And I say, sure, can you show up at our event? We'll put you on the program. We'll get you to speak, right? You'll have lots of lawyers come up to you, and that's what happens, right? Lots of local lawyers come up to them, and then what you end up having is this network develop of people who get to know each other. And to me, this is what I always believed, and now I think I've observed through the years, is what should happen, which is the development of legal services marketplaces in all the ways that business school guys would just talk about international business marketplace development. And so I never really saw some sort of fundamental purpose for PIPA within that sort of context. Okay. Now also then I want to say something about the notion of trust. And that gets at the marketing issue. If you are going to exist, then what I always was suspicious about was the marketing strategy. The marketing strategy of a website. I've done a lot of this stuff in developing countries for a long time, and I can tell you putting on an educational event is way complicated, difficult, labor-intensive, and it takes a huge amount of my time. Because a lot of it's got to be done very personally. Because very few people are on email, depending on which country you're talking about, but very few people are on email. And so first of all, you got the problem that nobody's on email. And then if they are, it seems like they don't even read it half the time. I'm being a little bit rude here, I know, but I'm just telling you the facts, right? When we had 200 people in Sao Paulo. Sao Paulo is not Kampala, right? And we have to send out personal invitations and make phone calls. We have local people making phone calls to offices, and that's how we got 200 people there, right? And by the way, a lawyer who was there joked with me. He said, Mike, I can always count on that half of the GDP of Sao Paulo is here when you throw an event. It's not luck, and it's not email. I'm telling you, it's not email, okay? So this email website strategy won't work, to which my friend Michael says, we don't have any money to do anything more. I say, I hate to say this, but that's what I thought 7 years ago.
You'll never get enough money to have more than just a website. And if you only do a website, you're not going to get anybody. And here's the other thing, trust. Which one of you is going to hire an attorney based on sending an email in which you've X'd some boxes, which you don't even know which boxes to X, as was eloquently pointed out by Joan there? How is trust established with that? On the other hand, my model, which is random or perhaps friend of mine, sometimes I'll admit I recruited a few lawyers who want to be part of us, come down there, be there, allow people to meet, you sit down, you have dinner, you establish a relationship, a friendship, people start to trust you there. So my message, which I kept trying to get out of giving, was that you really have to get beyond this website-based marketing strategy. It's got to be much more personal, and I think it's got to be one other thing. I think it's got to be oriented around particular countries and regions with particular lawyers who want to do business there and who say, I'm willing to develop this over time, and that I'll donate my services. I'll give, you know, some clients can afford me. In any place, there are clients who can afford me, and I'll give them maybe a cheap price. Sometimes you'll get clients, you know, who are top 100 companies in Brazil, and those guys in India, Indian billionaires, those guys can afford your regular rate, and they want your regular rate, by the way. They don't think they're going to get a discount. So I think actually that there are ways to have this group be useful and sustainable, but I don't think that your present model is either. And I think that's the reason why after 7 years, you actually have a thin number of success stories to talk about. After 7 years, that's not a very long list. Now maybe the list is much longer, okay, fine. But I just think that there are structural problems with the model that have to be overcome.
So just a comment and then a question.
Yeah.
The comment is I think you're exactly right, and PIPA has always contemplated having, and Michael mentioned, local offices that then can do much more of the personal contact, recruiting, coordination function, which also is a basis for trust building. So it goes back to, and we should probably ask you where you got your money from to have the people, rather than having a website presence. And if you have any suggestions on where that kind of money comes from, that would be helpful. The other question, the question really goes to pro bono services in those developing country markets. Because, again, it's one thing to say you want to develop a legal market and legal infrastructure there. It's another thing to develop a pro bono legal infrastructure. Yeah. And that's really the premise of PIPA, is pro bono, not paid legal services. So what can you say about that?
I guess what I can say about that is that I'm still overall skeptical about the pro bono side of that. And I know that I'm saying that despite that we know the stories you tell, and clearly it has to be the case that there are lots of people in developing countries who cannot afford legal services. On the other hand, I will tell you that one of the things I say to people in the sort of the presentations we give, the educational programs and everything, is your business model has to include legal services, right? Because you all have stories here in the U.S. of techie guys or something who start up companies with bad lawyering, and then it all, you know, and then it turns out that's the biggest problem they got. And so what I say to people, because our programs are always kind of the intersection of business and law and whatever, I say to them, this issue has to be a part of your business plan. And if you're a startup company, then getting legal services has to be a part of that plan. And if patents and trademarks and copyrights and or are important to you, then that needs to be a part of your strategy. So I still kind of question the premise about the pro bono side, because I think even in poor developing country settings, they've got local attorneys who have to price according to the marketplace. And then what should come into play is the secondary marketplace I talk about how when they need filing to be done about, you know, well, let's look at it this way. If they need a trademark from the U.S. marketplace, then they can afford to hire lawyers. If all it is, now if it's a peculiar issue, like some of the problems that were discussed, you know, where they, like that great story from Kenya. You're going to find those kinds of great stories from Kenya. But I think ad hoc solutions can be found in that. A whole organization with so many committed people doesn't get created to solve a couple of ad hoc problems like Kenya. Or the story I heard last year about Nigeria and cloth in Nigeria having Chinese knockoffs. I mean, those kinds of things can be solved in an ad hoc kind of way. In fact, I invited that guy to speak at the UN because I thought it was a great story. But it's an ad hoc problem that can be solved with an ad hoc institutional mechanism.
Right. On the other question of funding for in-country contacts?
Yeah, in which case then, I thought Rita had the right idea there when she said, it seems as though the way to do it is to partner up with organizations. I think you used the phrase capacity building. There are capacity building organizations out there. I'm one of them, right? We do these educational programs that are, you could say, and certainly our proposals say so, that we're trying to build capacity here. We're trying to encourage people to want to do this, to learn how to do this as a matter of business strategy and the legal services, et cetera, the policy environment, et cetera. So I think that that Rita was right. It's partnerships with groups that are doing that kind of thing. And then through those partnerships, then you're showing up at opportunities then you're really going to get to know people. The idea of an office per se, like I don't have an office in all these places, I can't afford that. But I will tell you what I have worked to as a strategy, which is now going to, I think, going to bear fruit this year, which is that I've tried to get locals to want to establish an office. Initially, I always start with partnerships, especially with universities, and I got those in most places. Always I have a university partner helping us put it on, but what I'd encourage people to do is, if you think this is important, once you get a cadre of enough people, you end up maybe getting somebody who locally says, we can establish a center using some local money. It's usually local business money. They establish a center. Once you have that as your partner, right, then you have the local network then that you can be networking with. So I think Rita's idea is really right. It's the capacity building organizations, and then it's partnerships, in particular developing country environments with the right local partners.
And I think, Mike, you're right in the sense, yeah. I think in a lot of these countries, there are the rich people, so you can serve them as their, your clients. But
yeah.
And this whole idea of pro bono doesn't exist. I think that's where this having this capacity building through ourselves and partnering with the local institutions, like IITs are good examples in India, Indian Institute of Technology. They are rich. They have money flowing in from their alumni. And I think they, you know, that's just one example. But institutions that have money, introducing the idea of pro bono, networking face-to-face with them, creating little hubs right there. I think that's the model. But just long distance and there's somewhere something is getting lost because we
I give you an example on the IIT thing? Just to interject on that. My law school, and in particular the IP law program at GW, established a partnership a couple of years ago with the IIT Kharagpur, which is outside of Calcutta.
I know that program.
Yeah. And established a whole law school with with a focus on intellectual property and technology.
Rajdhavi, yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Yeah.
I was involved in the beginning.
But notice the plan there. Establish educational program. Create a base of well-trained intellectual property, and in particular patent attorneys, who are graduates of the IIT, who have strong science abilities, et cetera.
And money.
And it becomes, exactly,
yeah.
It's got money, and they become the network, right? Whenever we GW show up in India, we've got alums walking all over the room, right? And so this networking thing, trust-based relationships, et cetera, yeah.
And I think the other point is that BIPA has to distinguish itself from what is it that we're doing over and above that law clinics do in universities? There's somewhat, I think we do, and I can identify those functions, and we have to emphasize those.
And I think, in a nutshell, it's that it's practitioner-driven rather than professor-driven.
Yeah, exactly.
Which there's a number of differences you could list that come out of that. It's less theoretical, less educational, more practical, more based on experience. And that doesn't mean that you don't and can't have partnerships between practitioners and law clinics, and you do. But it's a different sector. And it's interesting because, Mike, I would say, and I really appreciate you're saying all those things, and they all sound correct. And and really, we are sort of in a catch-22 sort of spiral here. And but I think that you mentioned your economist view or business view on the legal marketplace. That's crucial. I think there's three sectors. One is the legal educational marketplace. One is the legal, the commercial legal marketplace. And the other is the pro bono legal marketplace. And I think those are different sectors and they have different needs and different dynamics. And I think that's a crucial insight to pursue. And the one thing that really makes clear to me is that one thing that PIPA has in spades is demand, if you will, for pro bono cases.
from attorneys who want to volunteer. They don't. Yes, there's a component of networking, education, and potential future commercial relations. Yes, that's all there in the background. But at its core, it is a volunteerism. I mean, there's a demand for volunteer projects, and that's a different sector. It is. I mean, you hear that from the people. So,
yeah. Question from Mike is that you described this program, Correct Variety, the collaboration with George Washington and the attorneys doing the work. How much of that now today, if you look at that program, how much of that is developed into pro bono work? I'm not sure if the pro bono needs have been served through that program. If it have, then I'd like to hear about it.
No, I would not necessarily. On the other hand, I'll say this, which is that, first of all, I'll answer no. I don't observe that the stuff that we have done has resulted in pro bono services we've done. I will say this, however, which is that if anybody at any one of these places we go to, and in my case, we only go to about five places. We're trying to build deep relationships over time, and I don't like this random going to different countries. I did that in the old days, and I thought it was a big waste of time. So, but if anyone ever comes up to me and says, I got this business plan, I want to do X, and it's critical, I need pro bono help, I personally would go about the business of trying to help them. The fact that a pro bono marketplace hasn't seemingly developed within my eyesight in the places where I go makes me suspicious there isn't really a great need for them. It's what I said about how it's idiosyncratic, it's occasional. It's like the Rwandan basket ladies that we've been working with. We started studying them a little bit as a study project, and we realized that they weren't intellectual property protected. It becomes kind of random over basket makers and such, and you can solve those problems. In your world, I'm not sure that there's a great need, your world meaning the bio area, there's too much money involved, right? Craft areas, there's a definite need, no doubt about that. And in the IT area, because of entry of small software companies, there's probably more of a need with the software, because then you might have a 20-year-old kid who doesn't entirely understand that he needs intellectual property protection, and he's got a computer. I've been told that by a number of software engineers in developing countries. Why did you get into the business? I said, well, because I and my friends said, we're smart and we have computers. That actually is enough, right? So that is a marketplace that may really need some fulfillment with respect to pro bono assistance. I would personally just like it happening with this nexus of the local attorney talking to Michael Gollin's firm or something, because, and Michael says, well, we can do that for free for you or something. So that we get this knowledge transfer, we get the development of the of legal services marketplaces.
Great.
So, Chuck, can we get you down, because I know you're
going
to have to go.
Thank you. I want to make some very specific suggestions as a longtime supporter of PIPA, but also
why don't you come down?
Okay. As a longtime supporter of PIPA, but as an appreciator of the critique that Mike just provided, I've got some specific suggestions to leave on the table, and a priority of issues that I think we need to address. As I prioritize them, it seems to me the first thing, even before funding sources, is improving our access to clients. And that's where I want to start. I agree with Mike Ryan that PIPA should see itself as a pump primer, that eventually, if we succeed, we should succeed ourselves out of business. There should be enough paying clientele and innovation entrepreneurship that pro bono lawyers are only needed as pump primers to get things started. At some point, clients should be able and willing to take on legal services, though the legal profession has got to figure out ways to provide creative fee structures so that startups can afford them. So my suggestion on developing clientele, international clientele, where I think our clinic at Washington University can provide some illustrations is through international research organizations. These organizations have on-the-ground activity in developing countries, and they know the needs. My work through the Missouri Botanical Garden has led to more work than we possibly could do. We also have the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis, which has a great deal of international need. Through my work at Missouri Botanical Garden, my longtime contact there is now the Vice President for Applied Research at the New York Botanical Garden. I've met people from the Royal Botanic Garden at Kew. All of these organizations have got contacts with developing countries and their biodiversity, biotechnology, traditional knowledge needs. So that's at least one place where I think clients could come to the organization in abundance. As far as funding sources, I agree with Dr. Khanna that there's probably a vast resource of funding in what I would call the intellectual property industries in the United States, who, if approached properly, will realize they've got a real sales job in the developing world for intellectual property, which does not have a good reputation among developing countries. And it should be in their interest to try to come up with a more user-friendly image in intellectual property law. I have actually fended off eager attempts on the part of a local company called Monsanto to give me money. I'm not sure I'm ready to deal with them quite yet, which is why I work with them through the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in order to launder the money, if you will, before I get. But I have a feeling that in big pharma, biotech, we would find more money than we'd need if we could just find a way to launder it so we wouldn't get so and also identified with those groups.
Also, if you can present it in a clean way, like Monsanto money will be considered tainted.
Yeah, I know.
So much bad in
exactly.
The past.
That's you'd have to get the fundraising in such a way that you could show people, we got this from lots of people, and there are no strings. We have independence in what we provide. And now, I don't know how you do that, but that, at least, I think, is a source. We just got to figure out how we could tap it without discrediting it ourselves.
Yeah, the one way to do that would be to have representation from developing countries on your board.
That would be the way, I think, to establish credibility. Right. And the third thing, and perhaps the most important thing that I would suggest, has to do with organizational structure, particularly in the use of our volunteers. This is a kind of a self-interested suggestion. And those of you who were at the conference yesterday may remember that I spent quite a bit of time asking, why is there no volunteer lawyers for innovators? We've got nationwide organizations of volunteer lawyers for the arts, but why not innovators? It seems to me counterintuitive that we should have the one and not have the other. And I'm currently involved in trying to develop in St. Louis the equivalent of our St. Louis volunteer lawyers and accountants for the arts, only for innovators. I've heard a tremendous amount of interest on the part of IP lawyers in town. Thank goodness we finally have some pro bono work that had some relevance to what we do as intellectual property lawyers. We'd love to do this. We just want to get the clients screened so we would not have to take every walk-in startup company, which winds up either bankrupting the client or bankrupting the lawyer when too much needs to be done before they can really use the services of a lawyer. So I would suggest one thing that people consider is basically branding and franchising. I wonder if you don't need local chapters. And I just told Michael before the conference this morning a modest success story in St. Louis. A patent lawyer in town who belonged to the IP boutique that represented Searle Pharmaceutical in a negotiation of a know-how license with the Agarona Indian Confederation involved in the ICBG Peru project. This firm was so provincial that they laughed about this hilarious negotiation in which their leading patent lawyer faced an Angaruna Indian with two lawyers to negotiate a know-how license where it was the Angarunas who had the know-how that were going to license its use by Searle. They never realized that their firm set an international licensing precedent in that Washington University conference room because they simply didn't have the breadth of view that they might have had. We talked yesterday a lot about getting clients lawyer ready, but I'm convinced we need to get lawyers client ready, and that to provide international pro bono, the clients are not the only people who face tremendous cultural divides that have got to be overcome. I think our clinic, through the development of an independent PIPA chapter in St. Louis, could in fact help educate the bar to provide more adequate legal services to locals. And the story I told Michael is this lawyer from this boutique firm that laughed about this licensing representation went to a larger firm where pro bono is now an acceptable and in fact required practice. And this lawyer came to us and said, I want to start a PIPA chapter in St. Louis. I heard Michael Gollum talk about this stuff. Basically, this lawyer had a kind of road to Damascus experience, even though most of his firm did not, and he wanted to work for PIPA. He said, I don't want domestic clients. I don't want St. Louis clients. I want to work for PIPA. Now, I'm trying to make that happen, and I think maybe we need to try to make that happen in more cities than just St. Louis.
That's great. Thanks. When you just a quick, I know you have to run, but just a quick definitional issue. The IP industry, so are you talking about the technology industries, or the idea that came to mind when you said that is also the practitioners and then all the associated industries, the annuity companies, the trademark search agencies, the searchers, and the drafting companies, and all
I
the,
think there's a huge,
you know, all the service providers.
Yeah, I think you can get into the service providers as well as big pharma, IT. The critical IP industries, but all their service providers as well.
Content and copyright content industries?
Yeah, sure.
Chuck, could you explain what you say? I didn't quite get it when you said get clients lawyer ready. Not that's not enough, but to get lawyers client ready?
Client ready,
and that's clear to me what you mean by that.
Well, when you take a typical patent lawyer and say some of the issues that you're going to have to talk with your client about is licensing that is compliant with conventional biological diversity or the FAO International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture. Your average patent lawyer doesn't know what they're talking about because they don't do environmental law. They do IP law. So in effect, I think pro bono lawyers have got to understand what the legal issues are of their clients in developing countries. They're very different from those in the United States. The United States is not a member of the CBD, so it's completely out of the field of vision of practicing lawyers. But the Missouri Botanical Garden knows we've got to comply with this treaty because we work in countries that are members. So we need to understand it. And where do we get our legal advice on an issue that's not a U.S.
And so there's the substantive issues, and then there's the cultural issues as well. I mean, until you've traveled in developing countries, you really have no clue what kinds of, what world people there inhabit and how that relates to the environment that we inhabit. And it's very different. And you really have to walk a mile in their shoes, so to speak, to even be able to understand that.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of reinforce that from the intellectual asset management point of view. Technology transfer professionals in the U.S. public sector talk about a patent license being a technology transfer, which can be true. You're looking for a qualified business that has all the complementary assets and the distribution and marketing and so on. When I've worked in India and Uganda and so on, a patent license is not a technology transfer. In fact, technology transfer is more like what we talk about as extension in agriculture. It's actually getting people to use the technology. So I'm just reinforcing, people tend to have a mindset based on their experience, and you have to do a lot of listening to understand what the issues are. So I just would my experience backs up what you said.
Thanks, Chuck.
Sorry. Okay. Do you want to go
back? Sure. And Judy, do you want to come up and
say credit?
Hi, Rick. So Rick Reedy is here, works with the International Intellectual Property Institute, another, shall we say, member of the same marketplace of NGOs working with innovation and intellectual property in developing countries. So Rick, why don't you tell us a little bit about that and the topic at hand of what is the public interest and how do we promote it?
Okay.
I think you're doing a great job right now, but obviously there's always further to go. I mean, but just what I've learned about PIPA, for the record, Rita and Michael, I spent a couple of hours with them earlier in the week, or last week. It was enlightening, and I think it's a fantastic, it's something that can always be built bigger, but the idea of doing pro bono, I think, is never going to die, and there's always going to be a need for it. The International Intellectual Property Institute was started about 10 or 11 years ago by Bruce Lehman, as we properly pronounce it, after he had been the longest-lived commissioner of patents and trademarks here in the United States under Bill Clinton. Bruce is on a beach in Florida and sends his regards, otherwise he would be here. But he really wanted to be here instead of Florida, I'm sure. He started IIPI because after 6 or 7 years at PTO, being buffeted back and forth by huge corporate interests and there was an ethical conflict a lot of times, and you had the people who use the pro bono or who need pro bono, you had the developing countries, you had all these other interests against the American interests. Who was it who said the business of America is business?
Hoover.
One of them, right. So IIPI was started to actually go in and do conferences. There's a website, iipi.org, that has chapter and verse on studies and papers and a whole bunch of different conferences and meetings and things where the institute goes in to literally train members of parliament in new countries. You sit down and you talk with them, you explain them why they need IP protection, why this piracy on the street corner isn't really a good idea because it's not good for American business, but it's not good generally. And long story short, it's what we look at IP from this perspective and from Bruce's years at the PTO, it's a basic building block of capitalism. Now, for the past 8 years, we've tried mightily to get the folks that were running the show in Washington, D.C. to pay attention to the idea that nation building is more than just guns and going in and blowing things up and then having to go and rebuild them while somebody else blows them up again. And we didn't get anywhere. My personal background, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a PhD. I spent the last 20 years in Los Angeles as an entrepreneur. I started a venture capital company and had a record company and did all sorts of crazy things for a while. So my personal view is from the perspective of somebody who uses IP. And I've seen it stolen. I've had it stolen from me. I've seen the need for collection societies, for artists. I've seen, you know, the music industry when I was involved in it was morphing from selling CDs and now having them stolen. So the business model is now owning the intellectual property, owning the songs. And so the big record companies are secretly going around and buying up all the music rights, and it's a very interesting thing. But so I come from it from a purely business development standpoint. And what we are doing now with, I would say, surprising success at a surprising speed is convincing the new sheriff in town and the people that work with him in some of the departments that there is a need for everything that is being done here. That nation building consists of something that's a lot broader than what the last folks actually had in mind. And tragically, because they claimed to want to do more than they ever picked up a telephone or sent an email about. So we have some good opportunities, going back to the idea of, we've talked to people about partnering on a lot of things, because I think you've got a fantastic network. I think it makes a lot of sense to husband resources by doing things together. We're, IIPI is partnered with everybody from the street law program that actually works on street corners to the World Monuments Fund out of New York that protects cultural IP in countries where the governments can't. And one quick example, one of the things we're looking at with the World Monuments Fund, which annually puts out a big list of the most endangered monuments in the world, whether it's Angkor Wat. They won't have the pyramids of Giza on it because Egypt is focused on that, but they'll have certain tombs in the Valley of the Kings where Egypt just can't take care of it. The temples at Angkor Wat were one of their big things. The Buddhas at Bamiyan in Afghanistan were sort of a loss, but that was on the list. What we're looking at is going back into Iraq as part of the reconstruction process because, the United States government went in there and we paved over the ancient city of Ur so that the Polish partners in the Coalition of the Willing would have a base to operate from. So now under the concrete and blacktop, someplace under there is this ancient city. The city of Babylon fared a little bit better. They actually demarcated some of the area so that people wouldn't go in there. But they did decide to fill 2 million-plus sandbags with the sand from the city of Babylon. And it never occurred to anybody that they should screen the sand like you usually do in archaeological digs. So we don't know what's... The idea being the cultural IP in just those two places alone is very, very valuable. Iraq owns Babylon. Iraq owns Ur. If we could dust up these places, we'd have cultural tourism in a second, and we'd have jobs for people, we'd have a source of national pride. And you look at this in all the different countries. It's not just places that we've gone to blow up, but other places as well. There's a lot of opportunity. So we're looking forward to, without going off on the internet and being very specific, a lot more open doors and a lot better funding opportunities very soon here. With the new administration and the new focus on what nation building should be and what America should actually be doing in the world. But all that said, I think PIPA is an amazing concept, and the fact that you have this network sort of at your fingertips is wonderful and can only be built on. To be complimented.
On that note, thank you very much. And we'll have time for discussion, and we started late because of technical issues. We have an hour scheduled for lunch, so we'll have time to talk. So we'll go up to 1:15. So let's turn next to June Blaylock, who has been at USDA for a long time as an IP professional. And tell us about your view on the public interest in intellectual property, which includes public service such as you provide.
It's really fun to be here this morning. It's a small but very dedicated group of people here, so it's been a really stimulating discussion so far. My interaction in this area comes from the fact that the U.S. Agency for International Development has a number of projects trying to facilitate the use of biotech crops in developing countries. And obviously one of the aspects there is the intellectual property rights. Certain literacy about intellectual property is necessary to move forward in this area. So this is in the early 90s. They looked around the U.S. government for intellectual asset manager from the public sector, from the U.S. government, who had expertise in agriculture, and that was me at that point in time. So it was a great opportunity for me. The very first project I worked on involved being on an expert panel for the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, or CGIAR.
That was a very interesting group because we had some very rabid anti-intellectual property folks on the panel. We did come out with a uniform recommendation that the CG system needed some source of trusted advice on intellectual property matters. For those of you who are not familiar with this, it's a number of agricultural research centers, mostly in developing countries. There's one institute here in Washington and one in Rome, but otherwise all of them are within developing countries around the world. So they, as a result of this panel, they set up something called the Central Advisory Service on Intellectual Property, and I've served on the expert advisory committee there. Again, AID's interest is that they're a donor to the system. The international centers work with the local national agricultural research organizations within the countries where they do their activities. And so they're involved already in many aspects of training and capacity building. And so the idea was to try to bring in knowledge about intellectual property rights as part of that training and capacity building. And it's through CASIP that I became aware of PIPA. So, and I don't know, Michael, has Victoria's office used your services? Or?
Yes, and Victoria's been on the advisory, international advisory committee since the beginning, and as, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Victoria has been on the international advisory committee from the beginning, and we have, I'm trying to think if there are any specific matters that we actually did matching, and it's not coming to me at the moment, but I don't have a whole catalog in mind, but we've pursued a number of initiatives to try and expand that, and it seems like it should be a very fruitful collaboration.
Well, I do think that there is an opportunity there working through the national agricultural research systems that are developing their own capacities. I think there's always an opportunity for training through that project. I also work on an advisory board for something called the Agricultural Biotechnology Support Project 2, which is a USAID grant to Cornell University. And the idea here is that this project is to assist local researchers in the developing countries to develop actual products that would be useful to their markets. This is in the biotech crop area. And certainly that project has, because they're focused on near-term product development, then there has been a lot of concern about access to third-party intellectual property. They started out with many projects and got whittled down through the years based on how commercially viable the products look like they would be. And I must say with the products that they've ended up with, access to third-party IP from the multinational corporations has not been an issue. The four projects that look very close from this are the BT egg plant in India, where Monsanto actually licensed rights to a commercial company for the hybrid seed, and the open pollinated varieties are going to be released through Tamil Nadu Agricultural University. So that was a quite access. As you say, Monsanto doesn't have a good reputation, but in this case, they've been very helpful because second project is a papaya ring spot virus-resistant papaya in the Philippines. It's a different virus than the one that's in Hawaii, so they had to redo their own genetic construct, and that was actually done in Monsanto labs with their assistance, and that's then gone through locally through their regulatory process and very close to release in the Philippines. There's also a potato late blight resistance project in India and Bangladesh. And then in Uganda, black sigatoka is a fungal disease of bananas, not dessert bananas like we eat, but matoki, which are the starch bananas, which is not only is that project going very well, it's really helped to develop a lot of capacities within the country. This is really, from beginning to end, a Ugandan project. The research is all in country. the regulatory systems are local. It's all support of the local government. So for a crop that most of the rest of the world doesn't really care about. So I think this has been a very powerful project. But the takeaway there is that there's a lot of fear-mongering about not being able to access third-party IP. That's not been a problem for these projects. I'm not suggesting that there isn't necessity for transactional help, but that's not been necessary here. And then as a result of working on this, AID said, okay, well, for the ABSB2 project, it was sort of case-by-case intellectual property management, which, by the way, is a very good training tool. It's the best way for people to learn how what this is all about. But they realized that there were other aspects of intellectual property management capacity building that weren't being addressed. And so AID gave some pilot project money to Michigan State University to develop a mentoring program with institutions in India that wanted to learn more about technology transfer. And again, I'm in the agriculture space, so we worked with Indian state agricultural universities, more particularly the Haryana Agricultural University. And outcome of that project is that they were the first state agricultural university in India to have their own intellectual property management policy, which is available online on and off. Sometimes the website's not up. If any of you want to take a look at it, I think we succeeded in part what we were trying to do, which is to have them develop their own policy and not copy ours. So you, some of it may leave you scratching your head. It's not a perfect document, but it was a self-generated document through a mentoring program, and I think successful in that way. And as I say, they were the first institution, agricultural institution in India to have such a policy. So if I could just sort of summarize, this has all taken place over the last 15 years. There's been lots of projects. So I would say that 15 years ago, the developing country viewpoint was that there were users of proprietary technology primarily, and that intellectual property rights were a tool for exploitation by multinational corporations. That was really the attitude. At the same time, there were lively public debates about TRIPS implementation and whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. And they more or less viewed intellectual property rights as an obstacle to getting research and development projects done. Currently, the situation in India, which is where I've been most often, is they have now they had a very lively discussion on TRIPS, and they now have laws implementing IP protection in all areas. Enforcement issues still remain an issue. So I would think that in the future, there may be more of a need for some pro bono help just in patent enforcement actions. Indian scientists view themselves as creators of intellectual property, not users, which is a major sea change, and I think maybe the most important outcome of all of this. There's a good conceptual understanding of intellectual property, so the need right now, in fact, you know, the demand is we want some mentoring, we want some hands-on help, we want to come to the U.S. to do internships, we want some help on case-by-case management of the asset, but they have a lack of access to legal and business expertise on a routine basis. One of the interesting things, one of the other universities I worked with is Kerala Agricultural University. That's the Spice Coast of India. It's a very beautiful place. And they're relying very heavily on geographic indications, but they don't have a really good idea of how they're going to enforce them. I naively made a suggestion, well, what about trademarks? And the response was, well, these are all small farmers. None of them can own a trademark. I said, well, this is how some small farmers in the U.S. became very profitable. I pointed out that Tropicana, Ocean Spray, Blue Diamond, these were all grower co-ops that were successful because they created trademarks. So I would think if in moving into an era where folks are seeing themselves as creators of intellectual property, I think the trademark might be very valuable to them if for anything that's an export market. I'll just end by saying that at Michigan State wanted to institute this sort of mentoring program. We went to the Association of University Technology Managers and talked about our experiences in South Asia. There were tons of people willing to volunteer on the transaction basis, even willing to have interns. The problem is that we can't find funding for that project, so this seems to be, you know, we certainly went to USAID, but they don't have a pot of money specifically for intellectual property management projects. I mean, it has to be tied to something else they're working on. So,
Joan, just following up on Rick's comment about the new
Following up on the comment about the new administration and the new approach to international diplomacy, have you seen anything at USDA in terms of a new agenda, or when do you think that will be coming forward?
Well, USDA is involved in this, is sort of tangential. It's basically the agriculture group at USAID. And my understanding is that their funding situation looks better, but and they will still have funding for biotech crop projects, but there's no pot of money that's really allocated to this. I'll give you an example. The American Seed Trade Association is very interested in plant variety protection in India. We tried to, we actually found some Indian seed companies that wanted to participate. And we made an application for AID funding, but it just didn't fit in any one of their pigeonholes. So maybe as this discussion goes on today, we need to look a little bit more about these funding sources and understand how they have things pigeonholed a little bit to maybe sort of tailor what you're doing to what they're looking for.
Great. Okay. So next, Ashley, so if you can talk a little bit about your experience.
Sure. My name is Ashlyn Lembrey. I'm from Franklin Pierce Law Center. I run the Intellectual Property and Transaction Clinic. And actually, just as shorthanded, my clinic is a lot like Josh's clinic here at Washington College of Law in the sense that I represent nonprofits, small for-profits, and artists in connection with trademark and copyright counseling, registration, adversarial matters, so cease and desist letters, responses to cease and desist letters, infringement issues, and we also deal with nonprofit formation, business entity formation, website issues, 501c3 applications, and litigation in some cases. So in connection with that, we've dealt with photographers, sculptors, book writers, musicians, painters, film producers. We have a lot of green or earth-friendly clients that might advocate, say, a change of laws for to enable people to use clotheslines to dry their clothes instead of dryer, or sell organic and earth-friendly products. Producers of school guides and who else do I have? Financial aid services, mobile home park co-op organizers nationwide. And another really cool one is Musicians for a Cause. We wrote a contract that Natalie Merchant signed to create music for a cause. But anyway, so that's some of what I do, and that is admittedly more domestic-focused, just like the AU clinic. However, I guess I should be an ambassador for another clinic, another intellectual property clinic at my school, which is run by Stan Kowalski. It's the Information Tech Transfer Institute. Within that institute, our students will work on patent landscapes in the areas of sweet potatoes, golden rice, cauliflower, I think they've got, HIV vaccines, and again, I might get some of this wrong because it's not my clinic, but similar, working on patent landscapes that eventually they'll produce a book this thick with the patent landscape, and that's used by others within the PIPA network to either get a license as needed, or researchers then can develop a certain plant variety or whatever. Seed. We also, that his clinic also works with government officials in developing countries to help them develop their IP laws and practices and rules and help them structure. And so that's actually a more of a newer project to help them structure what they're going to do and basically have structure, because right now a lot of the developing countries, the registration of IP rights is so ad hoc. It's really inconsistent. There's not one place you go for how to register a mark or how to get a patent. It's just very informal, and that harkens back to what Mike Ryan was saying earlier, that you really need that person-to-person contact. But actually, I think the developing countries would benefit from that, from more of an institutionalized procedure for intellectual property, so that you don't need to have that network, and you can have a little bit more of a commodity-like experience. And in that sense, it will hopefully empower the people who can't afford the special connection lawyers to actually get their IP rights protected. So I know Stan is working with that, and I will be working with him on that project as time goes on. So in that sense, that helps with that capacity building in the developing countries. And then the last thing I want to comment on is India has come up a fair amount today. Just my two cents on India. We have a number of international students up, and my school is really known for intellectual property, perhaps I would say probably more abroad than domestically, and among the countries, among especially the Asian countries, among them India has a strong contingency of lawyers will come. They have their LLB, is it called, in India, and they what the students tell me is that they really need that American education, in part because of the educational system in India, and also because there's demand for Indian lawyers to absolutely know U.S. law. But that's my two cents on capacity building in developing countries, at least in as it deals with India. Oh, and the last thing I wanted to say is, sorry, to the extent that, you know, while I went through this laundry list of people I help, I don't consider those PIPA projects, but yet they perhaps should be. And I'm wondering if, you know, seeing as funding is an issue, I don't know if you produce reports that say, oh, we've helped this many people and here's some of our stories. I know you have some, but maybe you need a registration system for...
Well, I think one thing that's quite clear is that we don't tell our stories well enough, and part of that is because PIPA is perhaps a little more isolated from the actual day-to-day casework than the clinics. The clinics, you know, are in actually representing, they're like a law firm, they're actually handling the cases. So one of the problems we have is gathering adequate detail about what actually happened and what the results are, and then to be able to tell that story is crucial. I think that's really one of the lessons. But we do have a case studies document that lists some, but we need more of that. And I think that all of the clinics and so forth and do, and actually just to have a communal knowledge base of what the stories are from clinics, PIPA, and others, I think Mike Ryan's experience and Fred's as well, I think would actually be a treasure trove. Like Autumn, the Association of University Technology Managers, has an initiative where they're just telling stories about the results of university research and the impacts on society. Beautifully well-researched, great stories, and very, I think, high impact. But with that, let's go to Fred, and then we don't have a whole lot of time, but we want to have more open discussion on the kind of drawing conclusions on essentially where do we find clients and where do we find the resources to meet their needs. And the bigger question of what is the public interest?
Oh, can I interrupt then for a second? So if I receive more intake at my clinic than I can possibly handle, so I could just say
Well, if you have international needs, then surely that's the kind of thing which PIPA can help.
But the best route is that click-through form or not?
Well, unfortunately, currently, without regular staffing, that's that and email and calls. When we have, in the times when we have full-time staffing, then that's a call, and then there's handwork and the time that goes into that. And as you know, it takes a lot of time to do the intake to get the clients ready to identify their needs. Mm-hmm. So it just takes hours and hours and days sometimes, which we don't currently have, because we have a lot of volunteers who are ready to represent clients, but we don't have a lot of volunteers who are able and willing to do the matchmaking for other people.
Let me make an initial observation, and that is, I think in the legal profession, and it's, I think it's true across all areas of knowledge, there are just too many silos. We've spoken a lot about intellectual property as if it's something that kind of stands on its own. I don't think that in the real world you can actually make that kind of distinction. I think that you really have to look, if we're talking about providing legal services, I think you have to look at IP as part of an integrated set of services that legal professionals are or should be prepared to provide. I also agree with Chuck's comment that lawyers have to be made client-ready as well as the converse of that, because we find, and I found in the three programs that I ran, both first in New York, then at the University of Maryland, and now in at the Center for New Tech Enterprise, that there are many lawyers who have, you know, spent their time in large firms who are very much used to the way those firms conduct themselves, who, when they now have to start working with small clients, find themselves really kind of cast adrift. They don't know how to relate to small clients. They don't know some of the issues, and particularly if we're dealing with matters that involve other countries, they're kind of woefully ignorant on what some of those issues are. And I think in a way this presents a wonderful, the current economic crisis presents a wonderful opportunity. In fact, it's one that we're pursuing very aggressively to try to find lawyers who are now, so we say, in transition and retool them so that they can become client ready for at least the kinds of clients that we typically represent, as well as the kinds of clients that PIPA is interested in working with as well. As I mentioned earlier, our program is a multidisciplinary web-based program. We have, in fact, we've become something of a magnet for scientists. It amazes me now how many people who are getting PhDs in various scientific disciplines, as well as postdocs who are nearing the ends of their fellowships, have decided that they do not wish to pursue careers in academic science. The point that we typically find them, they're somewhat panic-stricken about what their alternatives may be. You know, this tech transfer, they're, you know, perhaps going to law school, you know, getting an MBA. But this actually opens up a number of alternatives to them that I'm sure that almost all of them have never thought about. And I think that this is that while we think of IP or even IP management as something that is typically reserved to the lawyers, I think it's equally important to acknowledge that there are those who do not have JD degrees who can play a very important role in the kinds of activities that we are, have been discussing today. I didn't know a lot about PIPA before this morning, and I came because I really wanted to find out more about it, see whether or not this was something that could conceivably fit into our system. Typically, we charge our clients a minimal fee, usually less than a babysitter would charge them, but we feel that it's important for them to have some skin in the game and to realize that in the real world there is no free lunch. Having said that, however, I think it's also fair to say that the kinds of projects that we're talking about for FEMA in developing countries may require a different approach, particularly if we're dealing with crafts or indigenous projects and not necessarily with the technology-based projects that we typically see. Now, I mentioned, and I want to make a point of say something about what Mike Ryan had to say. We're web-based because we recognize that, at least in this country, there are many areas that are underserved in terms of getting professional services and having access to capital. And while it is not an ideal solution, the technology does exist for people to at least be able to see each other on computer screens and at least recognize that there can be some kind of face-to-face communication, even if it's not in the same room. Having said that, we are approached frequently by economic development directors of various cities and counties throughout the country that want us to help them set up technology corridors or set up programs by which legal and business assistance can be provided to other kinds of companies. We're actually going to be participating in one such project in Northern Virginia. And for this one, we're actually setting up a hands-on center with students, again, from various disciplines, with lawyers and other professionals who will actually be at the center providing hands-on services to the kinds of clients that we expect to see there. And that becomes important, at least in our structure, because as we think about doing things outside the United States, we recognize that we really can't do it all from here, but that ultimately we may have to do some franchising or set up some operations outside the country. And to the extent that we need to do that, it gives us the opportunity to be able to develop the trust that Mike was referring to and be able to have a hands-on presence in some of these places. I've come away with this thinking that there is significant room for collaboration between our program and PIPA. I think some of the areas of interest and in mechanics certainly need to be worked out, but I can certainly see that in our situation, not only being able to provide IP assistance, and looking at IP not so much from a defense to being exploited, but rather a way to empower people in other countries to be able to build wealth from the ground up, not only is important from a public interest point of view, I see it as important from a national security point of view, because if you look at, for example, the environments from which the Somali pirates come, you're dealing with a failed state with no real future in terms of legitimate kinds of wealth creation. So they turn to attacking, ships in the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. Conversely, or at the same time, from the standpoint of providing people with hope and the ability to empower them to have certainly greater control over their not only over their lives but their economic destinies, I think that the national security interests of the United States are better served than not having programs such as PIPA. So what I've come away from this is with real interest in seeing how we might be able to pursue a collaboration with the organization.
That's great. Thank you, Fred. So I'm going to transition us, and Michael will lead the final discussion in the little time that we have left, to going back to what I've heard from today, which can roughly fall into three categories similar to what Michael had just previewed. The first is it is clear that there's a need for more funding to be able to support the matchmaking function. And we need to think about how that's going to come, where the money is going to come from, what kinds of partnerships to develop. The second piece that I've heard is that there are a number of opportunities to and a need to really develop more extensive partnerships and more extensive presence in the developing world to both generate clients and to assure that capacity is built in ways that a legal services network develops that can also do some of the pro bono service provision in country. And the third piece is this kind of getting the clients in a position to make better use of the lawyers who might be available. So any thoughts that anyone has that they'd like to share about the funding, the international cooperation and capacity building, and the client development issues would be really welcome at this point. And you are.
I'm Samuel Serapio from Beta Bahad. I thought I was supposed to speak, but it's okay. I'll speak now. This is geared towards both the client development issue, but actually while you were talking, I just thought of, I think one of an interesting opportunity that may exist for PIPA as an organization would be to actually use an MBA or a business school student, maybe for the summer as a as an internship, to look at some of these funding questions, develop a sort of a business plan of sorts for to tackle some of these in particular. And you can get those for free usually if you work through business schools. Generally, they have like funds for folks interested in working in nonprofits for the summer. So that's number one. The second thing is, I think, an important consideration is this, and I'm coming at this from an entrepreneurial perspective, is the definition of the client for PIPA, because I think the statements that were made by Mr. Ryan earlier and sort of what I'm hearing from you from the public interest, there's a difference between, let's say, a client in a developing country who's an entrepreneur and a business in a developing country. So if you have a pharmaceutical company in India who needs assistance in really understanding the IP terrain to get their product to the market here, it's different from a craftsperson. So to be able to identify those as being separate, respect the separateness of and the different needs that they'd have, I think would help in sort of moving forward. And I think the function and the sort of tools that are available with PIPA right now really serve best the entrepreneur in these developing countries, from what I've heard today. And then in terms of funding sources and also client development, and there are a lot of foundations, and I think would be a good partnership with PIPA, that are targeted at entrepreneurship. I'm not sure if you've looked at this before, but like the Kauffman Foundation based out of Kansas City, the Skoll Foundation for Social Entrepreneurship. There's a lot of foundations that have really taken shape in the last decade or so geared around entrepreneurship. And within those disciplines, I actually interned at the Kauffman Foundation for a moment, they have specific sections that look at knowledge transfer and the IP related to that. And most recently, I think they're starting to look at international entrepreneurship. So I've seen some projects with the UK. I'm not sure about the developing countries. But nonetheless, those are areas where it's a direct and complementary sort of objective and mission that I think they'd be delighted to sort of provide funding for. And then also it would assist in client development, I think, because if they're looking at issues of, let's say, emerging domestic markets or small businesses, community development organizations, through those you can find folks who would say, okay, well, my component has an IP-related issue, my business idea, which would come back into PIPA in sort of getting more clients. And then also another important thing that I wanted to bring forward for consideration is that in the developing economies, from what I heard, PIPA was really started by lawyers interested out of their own interest to provide pro bono service.
Yes.
Now, I'm not quite sure that if you'd have the same motivations by your colleagues in those countries, they may or may not, to provide pro bono service. And so, therefore, it may be difficult to find that network on the ground immediately. But whereas, it sort of lends to what Mr. Ryan was saying, so if you go into maybe on the law school students or people who are a little bit more on the idealistic, you know, stage, still out there thinking in those regards, you may find a better partnership for people to initiate sort of like on the ground, grassroots, eyes and ears to filter in, also who can also filter in more clients or potential clients. And also another good strategic relationship may be between NGOs that are working in the organic, because there's a lot of organic fair trade organizations out there who are also working with micro entrepreneurs who would probably also need IP assistance. So those are just a few of my thoughts.
Well, those are great thoughts, especially if I can characterize your presence here accurately. You approach PIPA as an assistance seeker.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking actually for pro bono assistance on a media project, and we can talk about that. But it just goes to show the point earlier that people who come in as assistance seekers in one area may actually have a lot to contribute and volunteer in other areas. So thank you for that. Anybody else, especially those who haven't spoken, I know there's a few people who come out of their own interest. If you'd like to make any comments or ask any questions, and then any other final thoughts from people. Anybody else? Yes, Rhoda?
Hi, my name is Rhoda. I am Kenyan. I work with Michael at Venable, and I think I'm hearing some worry about the pro bono aspect of this getting lost in everything, but I don't see that there shouldn't be a happy marriage between the pro bono aspect and the commercial one. And I think at some point, especially when you involve local attorneys, that aspect, of course, will have to be lost, because at the end of the day, I know the basket weaver from the village just wants to make money out of what they're doing. So the local attorneys will have to be involved, and at a commercial rate sometimes, though, of course, if they are part of the network, I don't see that they would have a problem with reduced rates for our assistance seekers. But they must be involved, and that aspect, I think the pro bono aspect will get lost there. But PIPA still comes in terms of advice, because as was pointed out, local attorneys will not necessarily be very experienced. Part of it is cultural. If I could talk about my own training in Kenya, is that we don't have, for example, the requirement that you be technical to practice patent law, which is something that you find here and something that you find with a lot of people that we work with in the UK, for example. So people can come in, for example, with the office actions and stuff like that, explaining the technical aspects, and that's a pro bono aspect, but the attorney locally has to be the person that does the prosecution. So I don't see that there won't be a problem bringing in a pro bono aspect into, say, patent prosecution or doing the initial screening of the technology or even the trademark or the copyrights at issue to decide, is this a case to then take on to a commercial level?
Right.
Yeah, so I think local attorneys will be key. And then there aren't so many practicing attorneys in a lot of these developing countries. So if you speak to... If I give an example of my country, Kenya, I can tell you off the top of my head which firms you're going to go to or which attorneys you're going to be speaking to. So organizing a seminar won't be that difficult. And then, or even just something that you do on the web, for example. But now through them, you then attract your clients because they are on the ground. They know what the needs are, and they will also point out the other issues that they have to deal with. In particular, I listened to what Rick said and about having to go and speak with politicians, because some of the problems are so rudimentary and you take them for granted, but it effectively prevents you being able to do your pro bono work, because if you're trying to enforce rights in an environment where treaties haven't been extended to, where treaties haven't been localized, even made part of the domestic law, then it brings up a need, okay, before we even have to take this basket weaver to the attorney, we have to go and speak with the politicians about ratifying some of this stuff. And then that becomes a pro bono aspect because that's education-based, yeah. You see.
You have to organize the whole region and the whole national level to be able to achieve that specific objective. But, and that's the way the laws really should arise, I mm-hmm. think, in when people need them to be there, not mm-hmm. because some international organization says that yeah. they should be there.
Yeah, so I think local attorneys will be key.
That's a great.
I really think they will be key, and they must be involved. And I don't think there should be any difference in the way you cooperate with them just because they're saying, okay, these are my rates. I'm not doing this for free.
Right.
It's okay. And these rates, really speaking from a local perspective, are not high. So that the people that need this assistance, for, and especially because a lot of them are in groups, would be able to scrimp together and put their individual little monies together and be able to work with this attorney. It's not going to be what we charge at Venable. You know, it's nowhere near that. I know the rates, for example, in Kenya. It's a pittance if you think about the legal fees.
What's a normal hourly rate in Kenya?
I have to do it in shillings, but the highest paid attorneys, for example, in a firm that I was working in, would be charging maybe something like 1,000 Kenya shillings in 2002. And if the dollar is at 70 bucks, 70 to 80 bucks, it's nothing, you know. And even if you got, even the funding that you talk about being little funding can actually go a long way
in
when you use local attorneys. And then the role that you play here is in advising those attorneys on some of the things like the technical aspects. And that's a happy marriage. And
it
has practical results.
So there's so much more we could be talking about, and hopefully will be. We've run over even our overtime. We have food. We're probably hungry, and we can continue to discuss. But the takeaway I get from that, which is essentially answering the question, how do we find clients, one, referring through local attorneys who can come get, you know, international attorney caliber guidance in partnership as a pro bono backup to them to help them serve the local clients. When we instituted our pro bono system, we decided that the hour is the hour is the hour. So an hour here and an hour there is equal. Because if you get and we've said that the PIPA volunteer should contribute a certain number of hours. So if you ask the local attorney to contribute some hours, fine. But then they should be able to charge, you know, their rates are so much lower than a UK or a US or a Japan attorney. But again, answering the question, where do you find, through helping local attorneys represent their local clients is a great answer.
I mean, the same musicians and craftspeople are at the restaurants or at the bars with the same attorney saying, I have this problem. The attorney's like, well, I can't really help you because I don't know how to do this.
But I know how I can find
somebody who knows. So I go to Pierce Law and I say, you know, Ashley, could you help me with drafting a licensing agreement? And funding doesn't even become an issue there because we're still dealing with purely volunteer.
We're dealing with volunteer stuff.
So this focus on funding, I think, is derailing part of the agenda, which has to remain local. And local doesn't mean here in the U.S. It means in Kampala or in Nairobi or in Buenos Aires. And at that point, there's just people are eager. And then when it comes to just making this a commercial venture, when they work at the local rates, it's something which a local musician should be able to do. And the funding aspect is...
But even the local attorneys are going to need to make the contacts, which still requires funding for the referral network function.
Right. It's just another sort of dimension of the networking and making use of, you know, say what you will, and Mike made very telling points. My view is that the website and the email is not sufficient. We never thought of it sufficient.
No.
But it's necessary. It's part of the network.
Okay. So we'll wrap it up here. And thank you all for coming. Thank you for viewing the webcast. And it is time to all get lunch on this beautiful day.
Thank you.